Sheets, episode 38, and we are here this evening to discuss the week of April the 5th through April the 11th, 1994. I'm your host, Chris Zellner, and I'm joined this evening, of course, by my co-host, and also the co-host of the great 605 Super Podcast, which we'll talk about later on, David Bix and Span. Bix, how are you doing?
Good, all things considered. I don't think we need to talk about how the show almost didn't happen today, but it almost didn't. Since it is, I'm happy.
People get sick. These things happen. So, but luckily, we're doing better and you're here. So that's all that matters in the end.
Yes, it is. I mean, we came very close to problems. This is probably the closest we came to not having a show.
Yeah. So far, yeah.
So, if that happens, then.
Yeah. It starts early, folks. Yeah, we had 37 shows, and now we're at 38, so we're keeping the streak alive.
By the way, I'm going to try not to run that into the ground.
Well, yeah.
It's not going to become redacted.
Yeah, there's certain names that deserve it, and it'll get played a couple of times at least on the show, so don't worry about it. Yeah, it won't be played every 10 minutes. But we are joined by a first-time guest this evening, which is always great. Although he's no stranger to podcasts involving myself, as he was a great guest on the three-part series of the History of Smoky Mountain Wrestling, Exile on Bad Street, The Hangman, Tim Knoll. Tim, how you doing?
Hey, guys. I'm doing good.
Great.
So, Bix, have we ever actually been on a podcast together?
I don't think so. And is this the first time we've ever talked on the phone in 17 years of knowing each other?
I was wondering the same thing.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing here because, guy, we all go back to the old DVR days. And, yeah, it's crazy how this podcast world is bringing people together. After all these
Bix randomly offered to help me get my public access show on in New York when he was like 15 years old or something.
Yes, very randomly. I just found the site. And, I mean, I guess you had been posted. Well, was the Death Valley Driver Board even up yet then? Yeah. But I think 99, I don't think the board was even up yet. I think it was still just RSPW and stuff.
I'm pretty sure the board was up by then.
But either way,
yeah, I think so too. But it was the early days.
I just emailed you out of the blue and I was like, hey, you like remember how Mike Lano got other people to run Canvas Cavity in other places? How about I do that for Wrestling Power?
And yes, Wrestling Power, of course. So one of the best wrestling public access shows ever, and introduce a lot of people to a lot of different styles of wrestling, which Between the Sheets does every week. And then Tim's a great guest for this type of show because, you know, he's a fan of everything. So let's go ahead and get it going here as we go to the World Wrestling Federation this week to start off with. And there's legal news here. This is 1994, so there's legal news. And although not the heavy stuff just yet, but a little reprieve for them. As in what was reported on two New York television stations on April the 6th, the U.S. Justice Department has dropped one of the two charges in regard to steroid distribution against Titan Sports. Sean O'Shea.
Sorry, you caught me moving the Skype current call thing around. And you got to it earlier than I expected. Say it again.
Yes. Sean O'Shea.
Oh, damn it. I didn't have the window. Say it again. Well, I didn't have the window focused.
One more time. We'll keep going. Sean O'Shea.
There we go.
Of the Justice Department, who was prosecuting the case against both Titan Sports and CEO Vince McMahon, indicated to WPIX-TV in New York, which teased a story news promo breaks all night long, that the decision to drop the one charge was for, quote, tactical reasons, unquote, while Titan Sports attorneys claimed on camera the dropping of the charge was proof that the government had no case. All posturing aside, whatever the truth is in these statements will become obvious in only a few more weeks. But the story was covered as a major victory for Titan because it guaranteed the company will stay in business after the trial. Although Dave doesn't really think there was any chance of the company folding, even with four guilty verdicts, although property loss would have certainly been a huge financial hit. Both counts against McMahon remain as of press time, which bring with them a maximum of 8 years in prison and $500,000 in fines. The two counts against Titan were for, one, conspiracy to distribute steroids, and two, for illegal distribution of steroids. Attempts to confirm which of the two charges were dropped by the government have been unsuccessful, and weren't reported on either news report. However, it's been confirmed that by the dropping of the count, the government is no longer attempting to seize company assets. Most importantly, Titan Towers, the $10 million office complex in Stamford, Connecticut. The dropping of the charge did eliminate any possibility of what would have been the most potentially devastating blow financially to the company that a conviction could have brought. But it had been known since the December Supreme Court ruling that it would be very difficult for the government to seize Titan Towers. It's believed that a December U.S. Supreme Court ruling on seizing of assets in drug cases was a factor in this decision, and that even if the government got a conviction, they would have to go through another expensive procedure to seize the building, and the mood of the Supreme Court was such that if it was appealed, the odds were that the government would be unsuccessful in seizing the building in the long run. The remaining three counts are pending, either a plea bargain, an 11-hour dropping of any or all charges, or a postponement scheduled to be tried beginning on May 2nd at the Nassau County Courthouse in Uniondale, New York. Now, Bix, could you...
My neck of the woods.
I know. Could you imagine if they seized Titan Towers, the scene that would have caused?
Now wait, would they have been able to seize it even without a conviction?
I think if they hadn't dropped this charge, is what Dave is saying, is they would have had probably the justification to do it.
It's strange to read, especially since asset forfeiture, or what's not asset forfeiture, asset confiscation. What's the term I'm looking for? Or it is called asset forfeiture, isn't it?
Yes.
That's probably more controversial now than it was then, even though they had the Supreme Court decision then.
Yeah.
That would have been interesting. And I honestly don't think, is $10 million a normal amount for something like that? Like, I don't remember ever reading how much it was worth before the building.
I didn't hear of it either. So that figure was kind of new to me.
Is this the current office?
Yes, Titan Towers has been there since, was it 89, 90?
Current office, but before like renovation and stuff.
Okay.
And this is also...
They did move at some point.
Did they have the separate TV studio back then, or was that all at Titan Towers at the time?
I think it was all at Titan Towers, but they've redone it.
And then they eventually added the separate TV studio. Like,
yeah, they've added separate.
Away.
Yeah. But the what you see on like Coliseum Video and the USA morning shows.
That was Titan Tower.
Yeah, it was the old building. No bar.
That was the studio that was within Titan Tower.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, and it's just crazy to read this. And Tim, you know, you look at the tumultuous times that WWF was in this period, and it the theory of them possibly having to go out of business, you know, even though it sounds far-fetched, I mean, it was wide open.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy to think about. So was this before or after Jerry Jarrett? I guess it's before.
Yeah, because they haven't gone to court yet.
Right, okay.
But so, he's already part of the company.
He's part of the company, but he's not in charge of day-to-day operations.
He's still shadowing Vince.
Yes. So he's there, but not in a position of power just yet, so... But yeah, this is the calm before the storm.
Well, he was influencing some of Vince's decisions, though.
Yeah,
to some degree. Probably not as much as he likes to say he did, because he always likes to brag. Oh, I made sure Vince put the WWF title on Bret Hart, and I had him put the tag titles on Kid and Jannetty, so I opened his mind to smaller wrestlers. The titles were on Kid and Jannetty for a week.
One week.
I think I was at the show where they either won or lost them. I think that was in Richmond.
Yes, that Raw show was in Richmond, the first anniversary of Raw, which we covered previously on Between the Sheets, I believe.
Exactly. On our last 1994 show, as a matter of fact. So, yeah. and that's a great segue, as now we go to Monday Night Raw. And this is the day still where Raw is a one-hour show, so not many matches going on, but it was a live show as they were in Utica, New York, at the Memorial Auditorium. And we had Lex Luger as the guest of the King's Court. Prior to this segment, Jerry Lawler was carried to the ring on a throne by four enhancement wrestlers, one of which was A.C. Connor, or as you may know, D'Lo Brown. I think another one was Barry Hardy or Dwayne. I think it was Barry Hardy.
Tony DeVito, I think.
Tony DeVito was one of them. I think Barry Hardy was one of them. Some of your normal Northeast job guys. But after arriving at ringside, the wrestlers dump Lawler out of the throne face first on the apron. Lawler, during the break, almost told the fans to shut the fuck up on the house mic, but stopped himself midway. Now, we have this audio here, and listen to Randy Savage here talk about Lawler, because this is what Savage did as the Macho King, but listen to how Savage, you know, talked about how Lawler was doing this.
Now, how much of this are we going to play? We're not going to play the actual interview, are we?
No, not the actual interview, just the first part.
It must mean it's time for the King's Court. Jerry the King Lawler, take a look at this if you would. Talk about an entrance.
It's not royalty, it's just Jerry Lawler. Just Jerry Lawler.
Big smile on his face. Look at this, he is loving this. The King, Jerry Lawler, making a royal entrance. No doubt of that. Only in the WWE. Only on Monday Night Raw.
This might be entertaining, but it's nothing like Piper's Pit used to be, not to mention currently the bottom line that Roddy Piper's doing. Vince McMahon, be honest. Now, come on.
Well, that's getting the shot. It might be.
This is brutal. This is boring.
Roddy Piper's not going to waste all this time.
I will not stand up.
No, I don't see anyone actually bowing. And
this is what I call dead television time.
Action for it. You can bet Lex Luger is going to give us plenty of action. That's
it's sure. Coming.
And we'll be back as we continue.
They're not wasting time. They're killing it.
Oh, wait a minute.
Ah, unbuck. Man, did you see that? What an idiot. King Foolish.
King Foolish.
We'll be back as we continue.
I can't believe it. That's so funny. I want to see his face.
What a funny.
Hey, stupid.
Yeah. And which was that Barry Hardy, Biggs, that was beside D'Lo?
Yeah, it was Barry Hardy and D'Lo up front, and in the back, I didn't recognize either of them. I was thinking with Tony DeVito, I think he was one of the guys that, when they would normally have the job guys carry Lawler out, I think he was one of them.
Yeah, now, Lawler taking this bump, Bix. I mean, you just watched it. He made it look like that it was not planned, the way he fell down. He did not take a bump that looked choreographed.
He did not take a nice, neat-looking bump. He took a Tully Blanchard-style bump.
Yeah, it looked like he actually hit his face hard on the apron. But,
how is that guy still moving around like a normal? He moves around well for his age, even if he wasn't a pro wrestler. I don't get it.
Lawler?
Yeah.
Well, Lawler was smart. Lawler,
he didn't take those bumps every night, but still.
He was never known for being a great bumper. I mean, he never was one of those guys. He was smart with it.
Although now, though, I mean, maybe not since the heart attack. I haven't seen as much of his indie stuff since then. Before the heart attack, every single indie date he did, he was doing at least, maybe not the Tennessee dates, but at least outside of, you know, driving distance of his home, he was doing the second row fist drop and that bump to the floor in every single match.
Yeah, but, you know, Tim, you saw Lawler a lot. I mean, he wasn't like, even a Dundee or guys like that, you know, that were taking hard bumps all over the place. He was very smart in the way he worked.
Yep.
I mean, it's just that simple. I mean, he was different than a lot of other people. He wasn't Flair, that's for damn sure. Now, going to Raw as a show, listen to these great matches we had. We had Diesel going over Virgil by powerbomb within 5:23. Shawn Michaels working as Diesel's manager, which appears he's going to do it all the tapings until he gets back in the ring. He's wrestling on dark matches on television nights as well. All right. Then we have Sparky Plug, Bob Holly, pinning Barry Horowitz. And then your main event was a WWF Tag Title match where the Quebecers beat Men on a Mission when Mo was pinned after sustaining the Tower of Quebec. And they got in this match because it was a 900 line vote. and they won the vote. And the match was an average match, but better than what it sounds like. Quebecers retained the title here. On the West Coast feed, they flashed a crawl whenever the 900 line quotes were going on, telling viewers not to call that voting had been completed. So, this was Raw before competition. Because, you know, this is the type of shows that they ran, you know, just your normal type of shows, which is, you know, some decent main event type matches, but...
But 1994 Raw was not 1993 Raw.
No. And some interesting names here.
Right. I mean,
Mo from King of Minimal Mission. Oof.
You know what, though? For as much as people romanticize the Manhattan Center era, it's really all of 93. The Mid-Hudson Civic Center shows are as good as the Manhattan Center shows.
What was the casino that they ran a lot in this time period?
Was it Foxwoods or was it somewhere else?
It was somewhere else.
Wait, Kutcher's was the place that Sivaldi ran, right?
Yeah, it was somewhere else. I'm trying to think about it.
Fernwood.
Fernwood, yeah.
It couldn't be real, but no, they were at the Fernwood Resort somewhere upstate.
Yeah, not Martin Mull or Fred Willard were not in attendance for those shows, but Raw in this era was just weird, very weird, but...
I think Fred Willard and Jerry Lawler would get along very well.
They probably would, but the guy here that sticks out in this whole thing is Diesel, and... Tim, this is where they were beginning to start spotlighting Diesel as a singles guy, starting to get him ready. And you could see that Vince was just drooling over the fact that he was going to make him a top guy.
That's true. Yeah, this was a build-up.
And Biggs doesn't remind you of what Enzo and Big Cass is looking like right now.
How so?
That Cass is going to be that Kevin Nash type, where he's going to be the guy that whenever they do break up, you know, he's going to be in the spotlight, Vince pushing hard, you know, while Enzo's the shorter guy with the charisma and, you know.
So you're saying that Enzo is the new Shawn Michaels?
No, I'm just saying, in like, role-wise.
He's going to fall in love with Big Cass, yes.
Yes.
Yeah, when I saw him on Monday night, I'm like, no wonder they hired this guy. He looks like the typical, you know, walking through the airport guy.
Yeah, exactly. He's a massive dude.
And you can't teach
it's that. Yeah. Sparky Plug. That's another thing that sticks out, too.
Do you remember his first video promo that they had?
Yeah, wasn't he supposed to be heel?
I don't think so, but he's like, ha, I'm Thurman Plug. And I apologize for the terrible southern accent, by the way, to my two.
I'm Thurman Plug.
But it was he was overdoing it, though. I mean, he was not using his real accent.
And Bob Holly was a good hand, you know. I mean, yes. He was a smoky. He worked in WOW in Mississippi. I mean, he was a good hand in the
Cornette
South.
Wanted him to be his top heel when he opened up Smoky.
Yeah, we talked about that on the show, Tim. You know, and Bob was on the early tapings and. It took him a while to get a spot, you know. He paid his dues.
What I was going to get to, though, was where he says, my name's Thurman. My friends call me Sparky. You can call me Sparky, too. And he says it in the most, like, you can tell Vince is coaching him, like, Warrior Oakley, goddammit.
Talk more Southern.
It's like that story from Ring of Hell where he tells Carlito to spick it up. His words, not mine. Not my words. Vince's words. Allegedly.
Somehow I don't think they're given that advice these days from Kevin Dunn.
No, that's not happening.
Although I know one developmental coach that's probably giving advice like that.
Oh, I don't think we're talking about him this week, so we'll stay from that. But, yeah, they can't do that type of stuff no more. Now, this Raw show did a 3.3 rating. Which is, you know, pretty good. And All-American did a 1.9. And Mania did a 1.5. And speaking of All-American, on that episode, on April 9th, Killer Kowalski said a tape promo challenging Johnny Polo to get his boys, the Quebecers, to put up their WWF tag titles against him and Gorilla Monsoon. Of course, Monsoon and Polo were the hosts of the show. Monsoon, who co-hosts the show with Polo, said that he would agree to a match.
What?
Yes. And I tried my best to find this clip, but I couldn't find it. But
All-American was really weird at the end.
Yeah, well, Gorilla and Johnny Polo was just weird. Weird and fun, but this whole era is weird. It's just a weird WWF era.
And then they replaced them with the team of Todd Pettengill and Ted DiBiase.
Yes.
who had negative chemistry.
Yeah, well, Todd Pettengill, you know. But Killer Kowalski and Gorilla Monsoon 1994, Bix.
What was the last match Kowalski worked? Because he worked occasionally on his shows for a long time.
Yeah, he worked indie matches.
But Gorilla had not worked since 1981,
yeah.
Who was it that he always claimed retired him, but didn't really?
Oh.
Who was it that he would always say on commentary had retired him? I should know this.
I shouldn't. I haven't watched a lot of Gorilla Monsoon commentary matches in a long time.
Who was it that Gorilla always used to say on commentary was who retired him?
I don't know.
It wasn't George Steele.
It wasn't Andre.
You listeners out there, tweet us or send a...
It was someone who was a heel during the mid-80s, right?
Baron Mikhail Sakuna or shit like that. I don't know.
I don't think it was Stud.
Ken Patera, Sergeant Slaughter, you know, I don't know. Mighty Joe Thunder. The Polish Prince. If you have that information, let us know on Twitter or Pro Wrestling Online.
Yes. Who's better, Mighty Joe Thunder or Rocky Mountain Thunder?
Mighty Joe Thunder's better. Rocky Mountain Thunder's one of the worst ever. Ever.
But he had a rope for a belt.
Well, who was worse? How about the Luchador Thunder or Rocky Mountain Thunder?
Damn you.
Okay, how about this? How about the TV show Thunder, WCW Thunder, or the Luchador
WCW Thunder, for sure.
Oh, man.
Now, was Thunder and Lightning Thunder NWO Sting or the other one?
I want to say he was Lightning. I can't remember.
I'll look.
But Thunder in wrestling is just, it's like global in wrestling, Vic. It's just not a good term together.
No.
And let's go to the land of the rising sun. All Japan Pro Wrestling debuts here, this section. And Champion Carnival Tour is going on. And some pretty big things here. Stan Hansen suffered his first two pinfall losses on the tour to Kenta Kobashi and Akira Taue on April 10th and April 11th. Now, among the top contenders, Dr. Death Steve Williams is the only one undefeated with a draw against Toshiaki Kawada. Kawada has a loss to Hansen and the draw with Williams. Hansen has the losses to Kobashi and Taue. Kobashi has a loss to Kawada and a draw with Taue, while Taue has a loss to Williams and a draw with Kobashi, if you're not confused already. So the key matches left are Williams versus Hansen, which Williams will probably lose since Hansen needs a big win and Williams can't afford a loss. Williams versus Kobashi, which Williams will probably win since Kobashi gained so much momentum beating Hansen that he can lose. And Kawada versus Taue, which Kawada will probably win because the winner of that match goes to the final. And it would be much better for Kawada to be in the final for the great championship match than Taue. Isn't that interesting line? Dave said to bet on Williams because Kawada will probably beat Misawa for the first time in a singles match this week. So Kawada can afford the loss in the finals, and it's time for Williams to be moved into equal footing with Hansen in the top corner spot. Anyway, those are all predictions, and we'll see next week how close they came. With Terry Gordy out of the picture and Williams' big improvement in 1993, expect Williams to be pushed later in the year as a top contender for Misawa's Triple Crown title. If he wins it, then at least it should silence UWFI from making any grandstand challenges. Now, the injury to Misawa, from all accounts, was legit, because it caused them to rearrange all the original tournament plans, and apparently Kobashi wasn't originally going to beat Hansen. The Kobashi win over Hansen in 26:55 at the Two Moonsaults was huge news, as fans were waiting years for that result. The result was probably brought on by the fact that All Japan needs to do more, quote, newsworthy, unquote, things, because its TV time was moved to 2:30 a.m., and because with Misawa out, Hansen had to lose another match. Misawa and Kawada singles match, the one that we just talked about, that was headlined the April Lemp Osaka show, ended up as a 30-minute draw.
Now, wait a second.
No loss for Misawa just yet.
Well, a few things I think of here. First, could you imagine the things that 1994 Steve Williams would have done to Takada?
Oh, man.
In a real fight. Like, seriously, think about this for a second. Especially since we learned that Takada had, like, shocked... It's hard to exaggerate just how bad Takada was at prize fighting.
Yeah.
Considering that you would think he had some skill.
Yeah.
And presumably street fighting as well. Because, like, they would put in tomato cans and one of them almost beat him while he was holding back.
Mm-hmm.
And then, is this the Misawa injury from the Doug Furness match?
Yes.
So we should probably talk about that for a minute.
I'm checking to make sure.
Is it this or is it the following year? I know it's 94 or 95.
Misawa and Doug Furness on March 21st.
Okay. Should I explain this one?
Yes.
Now, this was not ever reported anywhere until Doug passed away, was it?
No, actually. As far as I know. First I heard of it.
So Doug Furness and Dave Meltzer were pretty good friends, and when Doug passed away, Dave told the story about this in the bio for Doug, that Doug hits the Frankensteiner on Misawa, all of a sudden it's, oh my god, Misawa hurt his neck. And Doug feels really, really bad about it. And, of course, Stan Hansen's, like, really, like, telling him, like, you just hurt the top guy. You screwed up all of Misawa's all of Baba's plans. They have to rebook the whole tournament. It's so on and so on. So Misawa calls in Doug to have a meeting in the locker room. They send everyone else out. Misawa's in this chair wearing a neck brace, looking like crap, sends whatever young boys are with him out of the room. He gets up, takes the neck brace off, kind of gestures, kind of like cracking his neck, kind of, to show he's okay. I don't think he even says a word. And then the understanding is, maybe Bob explained it to him. I forget exactly, or if Misawa told him a little. But it turned out it was all a work, but they didn't even smarten Doug up. And it was because they needed to figure out how to book the tournament, and they didn't want him to take certain losses that they didn't want him to have to do jobs in.
Mm-hmm.
So Doug leaves the room smiling. Hansen's still berating him. And Doug's like, no. It was a work. He showed me and blah, 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 blah. And then Hansen says something to him like, and now the worst part is you're lying about it.
Yeah.
That's one of my favorite stories. I love
it. Yeah, I mean that's old school wrestling right there.
That's old school Japanese wrestling.
Yeah.
Sure.
Now, Kawada, of course, will win the tournament in the end over Doc in a hell of a match at the Budokan.
Awesome match. Same night as the J Cup.
Yeah, same night as the J Cup. Yep.
Same city,
yeah. Now, one name of note in this tournament before we move on is between Ishii's favorite, John Nord. Was in this tournament, and he ended up with 6 points. So,
how much did Kawada and Doc have?
Doc had 19, and Kawada ended up with 21.
Okay, that's really not as good as you made it sound.
Yeah. So, but anyway, but Tim, I mean, the story here is Kobashi. He finally gets that win over Hansen, and. This is like the beginning of, I mean, Kobashi, of course, had tremendous 93, but this is the beginning of him really starting to become, you know, right there with Misawa and Kawada as the guys.
Well, if you were into reading the Observer, you were on all over Kobashi for several years at this point, but yeah, you're right.
Now, what did you think about Kobashi as a performer in this time period? Did you see that this guy was going to be, if he wasn't already one of the best in the business, or what did you think about him watching him in this time period?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I thought he was one of the best. But, you know, All Japan was just on a completely different level of everything else from the heavyweights. I mean, you pretty much watched New Japan for the junior heavyweights at that point. So All Japan was all about, you know, the top four or five. I guess this was post-Jumbo, so the top four guys were pretty much seen as the best in the world.
Yeah, Taiwei is just about – I mean, he's working his way up. But, yeah, basically it was Masao Kawada, then Kobashi, like, right behind them. And, yeah, Hanson and Akiyama was a couple years in. Oh, yeah. Hanson and Doc had tremendous years, you know, going into this. And this was maybe Doc's best run of his career right now.
I wouldn't even put a maybe there.
Yeah, he was tremendous in this era. Just tremendous.
And you can argue, I mean, there's a lot of great matches in 94. There's a perfectly solid argument for that Carnival Finals being the best match of the year.
It's up there. I mean, it's definitely in the mix, for sure. Now, regarding that television deal, Akira Fukuzawa is no longer the television announcer since the show was moved to 2:30 a.m. The new 30-minute show is really sad to watch. It is simply just too short. The first episode aired on March the 2nd, aired 22 minutes of a 30-minute Williams Kawada draw and cut away right after the bell, and that was the entire show. This is, you know, it was frustrating as hell being somebody that watched Japanese television on a regular basis time period to have that happen, to go from the hour show to the 30-minute show. It sucked.
And they made tremendous use of the hour time slot, All Japan did. Especially, yes. Like, in 93.
Yes.
Like, they fit more into that hour than just about anyone else.
Yeah.
And they tried their best with the half hour, but it probably would not have worked as well with any other promotion, with any other, like, production team behind them. Because Nippon TV, I can't think of anyone else that did a good job of editing matches as they did.
They were the best,
and they made it seamless. They could cut like half of the match out, and you couldn't tell if you didn't know any better.
Amazing technicians.
And AJW was the same way. You'd see the time, and you're like, wait, they must have cut something.
Yeah. Whoever, I guess Fuji TV for the All Japan Women, they were up there too.
You wouldn't have known.
Well, now New Japan's with TV Asahi, however, they were not nearly as good. Trying to think who else. I can't think of anyone that was close to as good, really. I mean, then, you know, especially like when, you know, as watching American stuff on home video and stuff, and you're used to, you know, some of those WCW videos or some of the really hacked up WWF videos like Survivor Series 88 and that type of thing. It's a different world because they kept the flow of the match somehow.
Well, getting stuff, you know, in America, tape trading and stuff, it wasn't that bad with the half hour. But I can't imagine living in Japan and you'd be, you know, sitting there where you're getting half the match one week and half the next week for those epic, you know, Triple Crown title matches.
At 2:30 in the morning. That's the worst part of it all. You
right.
know,
and
yeah,
it got a little better in like 95, especially when they and then 96, because they started to release more commercial tapes, and they got the Samurai TV show. So it was better. But then, even though you were getting the main events eventually complete, and you know the title matches and all that, the undercard got badly shortchanged in terms of what we could see.
Oh, of course. They struggled more than anybody. The juniors, like, there's no telling what kind of Fuji stuff that we missed out on.
Fuji,
you know.
I mean, guys, like, Johnny Smith shows up on TV all of a sudden in like in trios matches and stuff, and he looks great.
Random foreigners and stuff like that. You know, there's no telling what all we miss. Now we mentioned Jumbo a while ago. On April the 10th, Jumbo wrestled in Sendai in the mid-card comedy match, teaming with Rusha Kimura and Mitsuo Momota, going over Masao Inoue, Ryukaku Izumida or Jun Izumida, and Haruka Aigen. And uses backdrop suplex finisher for the first time since October 1992 to pin Inoue. Apparently, as everyone has figured, Shiruta isn't expected to ever return full time, but will be used maybe every other month as a special attraction in a comedy match, as long as he can go in the ring. Now, Tim, I mean, that it was sad to see Jumbo, you know, get in this shape. He was so great for so long, and now he's become a broken down old man.
Yeah, I remember that, but it's not like I've rewatched any of that stuff since the time, so it's not really fresh on my mind. But yeah, I do have that memory of it.
When he'd work with guys like Misawa, like I remember, I think it's the undercard of the Kobashi Kawada 60-minute draw, the first one. There is a six-man tag that mixes the older comedy guys and the current generation. And when he's in with someone like Misawa, he still looks like Jumbo.
Yeah, there's a match. It was Baba, Jumbo, and Misawa against Akiyama, Omori, and Honda. That was a really good match from 95. And then you had Baba, Jumbo, and Akiyama against Taiwei, Fuchi, and Inoue, which is another good match, I remember.
Right. Now, he had hepatitis B, right? Not
yeah.
C.
Yeah, I think so.
And I mean, it contributed towards his death, right? Because didn't the liver problems lead to the kidney problems?
Yeah.
And then he was getting a kidney transplant in the Philippines and he died due to surgical complications?
Yeah. Now here's the match as I'm looking through Jumbo results here. Baba, Jumbo, and Hansen over Rob Van Dam, the Eagle, and the Falcon. Of course, the Eagle was George Hind. Of course,
Jackie Fulton.
Jackie Fulton. And the Falcon was Scott Armstrong.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know about that.
Yeah, the Falcon with Scott Armstrong. So, think about that team. Rob Van Dam, Jackie Fulton, and Scott Armstrong were a tag team.
I mean, throwing the Patriot in there, too. And
yeah. Ooh,
because Patriot and the Eagle. So, were Patriot and the Eagle as partners after this?
Before.
It was before.
Yeah.
Oh, right, because this is around when Patriot starts to get the bigger push.
Yeah. So, All Japan, you know, doing great at this time period. Just tremendous high-level matches. Then we go to New Japan. And their current tour has no foreign talent and drawn poorly, except for a sellout in Kumamoto on April 7th as Riki Choshu and Yoshiaki Fujiwara wrestled Great Muta and Hiroshi Hase. Muta had a rare DQ in. He had a rare DQ end as he blew mist in Choshu's eyes, and after the match blew mist to Fujiwara, Hase, and the referee's eyes as well. So it's a Miss Bonanza here for Muta. Now, April 11th, two of New Japan's greatest tag teams in history faced off as Power Warrior, or Kazuki Sasaki, teamed with Hiroshi Hase for the first time since taking that new identity. It faced off with Riki Choshu and Masa Saito, who, of course, a legendary tag team in the 80s, and Power Warrior Pen Saito. Now, on that same show, in a match scheduled as Muto versus Osama Kido, Muto came out as Great Muta, fighting the heel style, and was DQ'd again for blow and missed, which was the first time in Japan he used the Muta gimmick when advertised as Muto. After the match, Muta said that from now on, you never know when Muta will suddenly appear. Now, Bix,
is that a warning?
Yeah, I guess so.
Is it a warning to his opponents or the fans?
Maybe both. But yeah, I mean, the deal was Muto worked mainly as Muto unless the time of came for him to take on the character. And now it's a you never know what you're going to get.
Yeah. Is there anything as disappointing as getting your first tape of Great Muta under the gimmick in Japan? And then
ooh.
Seeing that.
Ooh, I hate it for you that did that.
I mean, could you... And then you need to learn. It's not a Great Muta you want to see. You want to see him as himself.
Yeah, it's not 1989 Great Muta, that's for damn sure. But, a lot of gimmicks going on here in New Japan this time. And, Tim, I mean, this goes into your theory about the heavyweights. The New Japan heavyweights had some good stuff. There was some fun stuff, but you compare this to what All Japan was doing at the time, and it's, you know, night and day.
Was this the end of Saito's career? How much longer did he go?
He worked in 95.
I was just going to say, he kept going in 95.
I think 96 was the end.
Okay.
Yeah, because remember, he came over here with WCW for Starrcade. He was in that group.
Okay. With Kimberly calling him Hop Sing on a promo.
Hop Sing from Bonanza. That's some old school smack you never hear anymore. Somebody calls somebody Hop Sing. I mean, that's classic. But yeah,
does she call him Hop Sing or does she call Sonny Ono Hop Sing? It's that match, though, right? Because Johnny B. Badd wrestles Saito, right?
It's one of them. But the Hop Sing reference was used no matter what. So. Yes.
If she called Ono that, I'm sure it's in a deposition somewhere.
All right, Bix, get on that. That's your line of work right there. So you need to find
Carl
that
out. Carl Stern would know.
Yeah, Carl would know too. Chris Harrington, all the great legal experts would know. But New Japan 1994 was a mixed bag for sure. Lots of different things going on. Now, as Bix had mentioned, the Super J Cup was going on the next weekend, which I'm sure we'll cover on this show at one point. Maybe next year when we get to that.
Someone was asking us to cover it, and then we had already picked 94 for this week. But
yeah, on record. So, I think I couldn't change it. But we got a story about that, which was at this time called Junior Wars. The show was. And Masao Orihara of War was injured this past week and had to pull out of the Junior Wars on April 16th. But we'll be replaced by Jado, who faces Dean Malenko in the first round. Now, Bix, think about if Orihara would have been in that J Cup against Malenko, not Jado.
When I'm reading that for a second, I thought I was going to see Motegi, which would have been worse.
That's the next year. But Orihara, God, that's a what if.
Is Jado like the least consistent, talented pro wrestler ever?
He's definitely up there.
Because he's not untalented whatsoever.
No, I mean, he had his moments.
He just wasn't that good most of the time.
No.
His peak was probably the FMW through Complete Players era, I would say.
Yeah, and that's a great segue because now we're about to talk about FMW. As FMW had a press conference on April the 7th for the Tenryu Genitaro Atsushi Onita match, and they ran an angle. Wow, what a shock. Onita gave Tenryu a present, which was a FMW video of his best matches, so he could see what an explosive barbed wire match is all about. Tenryu ripped open the package and destroyed the videotape, which got Onita so mad that he said he lost to Tenryu that he would retire. Then we have Mitsuhiro Matsunaga, Mr. Danger, showing up at the press conference, and he asked Onita if he could appear on the May 5th Kawasaki Stadium show.
Now, wait, was Onita upset because of how much videotapes cost in Japan?
I was going to ask that question. But that's the way to do a press conference there, Tim. Destroy somebody's VHS tape.
That's a new one.
And Tenryu doing it. I wish I had video of him doing that because I can just imagine him. He probably didn't know what a VHS player was.
maybe something got lost in the translation and they were trying to redo the good old TBS studio thing where guys would come out with the tape they had commandeered out of the command truck and said, "No, you can't show this footage because I got it right here."
Yeah. But can you, or think about this, Bix. Imagine Tenryu. If he didn't destroy the tape, taking the tape home, and we have a skit of him sitting as a lazy boy watching Onita's death matches and jotting notes down.
And with reactions with him in the Tenryu voice.
Yes, yes.
In the deep Tenryu voice, mumbling and...
Wakitahara.
I say mumbling, but every Tenryu talking sounds like mumbling.
Yeah, Wakitahara is massaging his toes.
He's setting up a spreadsheet comparing his lumps versus Onita's scars.
And then we have Mr. Danger. Every time he comes on, his name comes up on the show, I talk about him in the tape trading world. And Tim, you're great to be a part of this discussion. People don't realize how big this, we talk about it a lot, but how big this stuff was in the tape trading world. FMW, Mr. Danger. This style was so huge in this time period, Americans.
Well, Matsunaga was doing all the balcony dives, so at least in the early days, he was mainly known for, I don't know if it was the Barnett comps or different Japanese comps that would be out there. You just have Matsunaga balcony dive in the middle of all this other stuff, but you never saw a complete match of him for like years.
And then you had the piranhas.
Oh, yeah.
That was a famous one with him.
Setting his head on fire.
Yes. I mean, the guy was a tape trading legend in America in the mid-90s.
Those Barnett Japanese comps were interesting.
Yeah,
you'd have your UFC. You'd have what else? You'd have like fake UFC. You like Fight Zone. You'd have occasionally, if Bob shot something that he didn't put on anything else, it would be on one of his Japanese comps. there was one thing, and I've never seen it. I remember it, but it's something like Kyoko Inoue and someone, and he says something like, "Let's be friends," and she pulls an onion out of her nose. Like, still have no idea what he's talking about and why it's homoerotic and why she was pulling an onion out of her nose or whatever it was. You remember reading what I'm thinking of, right?
Yes.
Do you have any clue what that was?
No. This is the 90s, folks. I mean, this is the tape trading world of the 90s. It's something that could never be recaptured again.
And then you go to Dave's Wrestling Emporium and you get the thing with the JWP girls naked at the end. And then complaining.
What was that, Tim? What were you going to say?
Well, like me, it was, I'm sure, a lot of people's introduction to the Japanese wrestling, because people don't nowadays have no concept of how much we used to pay for these tapes. And if you were going to get a 4-hour tape of the best stuff, that was the more bang for your buck than trying to get like whole shows.
Or you'd get the introductory stuff. So it was King of the Death Matches, Super J Cup.
You'd get Barnett stuff, and then you'd know who you liked, and then you could do a deeper dive on the promotions you liked.
Right.
Yeah. But I remember like 92, 93 era, between me and my friends at college, we were getting most all of Barnett stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it was just a different world, man. It's just crazy, crazy times.
And by the way, for any listeners listening, we're talking about the late Jim Barnett.
Oh, man.
One now, for 22 for 35, my boy.
My boy, we got to make a cut of deal here. You know, we do bulk buys, but it's going to be, let's say, well, you get 5 tapes, you get them for $75.
But don't get that Jeff Strauch involved.
Oh, no. Do you know the towel boy, Eric Tottle? Back to Onita. Onita also announced that they would hold a tournament in June to crown a new junior heavyweight champion. This may explain why Sabu isn't in the Super J Cup tournament this week, because they put Sabu over after he's already done a job early in that. It kind of ruins any illusion about a claim as world champion. Imagine Sabu in the J Cup. That's an even more crazy one.
Because it went so well the following year when they tried to book him in the junior division.
I know.
Yeah, I don't know that he would have wanted to be lumped in with the junior division.
Or telling him he had the job to,
Motegi.
Whoever. Yeah, or job to Honaga or somebody like that. Oof. Again, more Sabu later in the show, folks. We talk about the tape trading era. This is when it's really starting to pick up a Sabu.
Now,
and he has quite the week this week.
Now, question, do you think that Jim Barnett was consulting with Misawa when he started Noah, and that's why Akiyama switched to white trunks?
He probably advised him on that haircut.
He had his claws and everything. I mean, you know, he was doing all sorts of consulting. Would it really be that surprising?
Yes. Yes.
It would be, or would
Masala-san, we got to go with the green ring. You know, green is the color of money. Oh, man. All right. AJW was mentioned earlier on the show, and we've got a lot of AJW stuff here. They probably have maybe the biggest news story of the week.
And it's good that they have the biggest story of the week, as we come a week after the first time the word Joshi has ever been said on WWE television. Yes. Good friend, Ronaldo.
Yes. I wonder who fed him that line. Shinichi Sports, a Japanese daily sports newspaper, which originally broke the story about All Japan Women's plan to sign Tonya Harding as a pro wrestler.
Reported, I should have gotten in the dun-dun-dun for that.
We're not through yet. Reported in a front page story on April 11th that a deal had been completed between AJW and Harding.
Oh, I didn't think that was going to be the. I thought you were getting to some other big development here. Okay.
For Harding.
All right.
To appear for one show. which would be the November 10th card at the Tokyo Dome. But Dave's Japanese sources close to AJW told him at press time that a deal had not been reached, but believed the chances of it happening were better than ever, perhaps 50% as opposed to less than 1% 2 weeks ago. This story hasn't broken as a press time in any other Japanese newspaper or television station. The story reported the contract would not be signed until May, but that it was 100% that Harding would appear for the one show. The newspaper printed a photo of AJW Vice President Toshikuni Matsunaga, the younger brother of Takashi Matsunaga, whose original quotes garnered considerable media attention several weeks ago in the United States, negotiating with Harding's lawyer and the American lawyer for AJW. According to the story, AJW opened negotiations with Harding and offered $380,000 to wear 50 days, starting with the Tokyo Dome and continuing through 1995. Harding's representatives in turn proposed $2 million for one match. The newspaper reported the deal agreed upon was close to $2 million for one match. Although Dave doesn't believe that that type of figure could be justified and exceedingly set, and is exceedingly skeptical of its legitimacy. It would be by leaps and bounds the biggest payoff in history of wrestling business. The story also reported the company admitted they would be losing considerable money on the deal no matter what the Dome House was. Apparently, they would be more concerned with setting an attendance record for public relations value of creating an aura nationally of even more of a women's wrestling boom than last year and getting on the map internationally that Harding's name value and a huge house at the Dome could bring than actually making a profit on the show itself. It is up to the court in Portland, Oregon, if Harding would be even allowed to accept the deal because terms of her felony plea bargain limit her travel to the states of Washington, Oregon, and California. Now, the story said the company is hoping Harding enjoys wrestling enough that she continues with it in 1995, but that Harding wouldn't commit to more than the one match to see if she liked it. Aja Khan was quoted as saying that she and other women would be happy to have Harding join their promotion because it would only raise the pay scale for everyone involved. The story also
that quoted, doesn't sound like a pro wrestler.
No. The story also quoted Etsuko Mita and Mima Shimoda as saying that they would want a team of Harding at the Dome Show and hoped that she would have enough fun doing the match that she would do it again. The story reported that AJW would attempt to pay-per-view the Dome Show to the United States, but that is a long, long way from happening, although it is true the company is attempting to get on American television. With a weekly television outlet, Harding's name value, and a great promotional effort behind it, the show would garner interest at the beginning.
Okay. People who were not around then have no idea how big a mainstream story this was. I mean, not just Harding in general, but how much coverage this specifically got.
Of course, for those of you who don't know, because this is 1994, it's 22 years ago.
Look up the 30. There's a 30 for 30 you can watch on this topic on you can look up on Netflix.
Yeah, Tonya Harding and Nancy Kerrigan, January 1994. It was a humongous, humongous, humongous mainstream story.
They were should we explain who they actually were?
Well, their figure skating.
It surprises me that it would be that big of a deal in Japan, though.
Well, the Japanese figure skating's huge. Figure skating's huge in Japan. Okay.
And wasn't the subsequent Winter Olympics going to be in Japan?
Yes, it was. It was in February. Yeah, Kochi, I think.
No, I mean '98 was in Japan.
No, '94 I think was in Japan.
No, '94 was Lillehammer. Nagano, I think, was '98.
Yes, you're right. '94 was in Lillehammer, and '98 was in Nagano.
Anyway, it was Tonya Harding's ex-husband or his henchman or whatever. Of course,
Jeff Galooly,
you beat me to the Galooly. That's what she said.
You've been Galooly.
Hit Nancy. They were the two favorites as far as American figure skating for that year in the Olympics. Galooly or his henchman, I always forget which. It was the other guy that actually hit her, right? It wasn't Galooly, or was it?
Yeah, he was the mastermind. Jeff Galooly and the henchman. Why am I blanking on his damn name?
It was another wacky name, wasn't it?
Yes, I'm trying to remember his name. What was his name?
David Kaleidoscope.
No, not David Kaleidoscope. Shane Stant.
Thank you.
And Sean Eckhart.
Yes.
Sean Eckhart was a big guy. Shane Stant was a little guy.
And they hit Nancy Kerrigan in the knee with the pipe or whatever after a practice.
Wearing a black mask and black outfit.
Which, if you've ever seen a whole lot of WCW angles, then
yep.
That's what it was based on. And it became this whole thing, and eventually Harding pled to certain charges and all this stuff happens. They both ended up in the Olympics.
Yeah.
Kerrigan got silver behind Oksana Bayul.
Yes.
Who was bronze?
I want to say Michelle Kwan, but I'm not sure.
Was that like Michelle Kwan's last year?
No, like, she was like last Olympics.
Oh, it was the beginning. Yeah, no, you're right. You're right. I'm thinking of, what's her name? Yamaguchi.
Yeah, Chrissy Yamaguchi.
And so it's this whole big thing. And then this was like the top story on Entertainment Tonight this week.
Chen Lu. Okay, she won bronze.
That's right. It was someone else entirely.
And Tanya Harding finished eighth.
Because of malfunction with her lace.
Yes.
And she ended up not being able to skate the second time or whatever. So anyway, enough about that. Maybe we should have explained that first.
And the thing is, I mean, it was so huge that it took OJ to knock it off the public mainstream.
This is the closest thing you could have gotten to the OJ trial before the OJ trial.
Yeah, I mean, and this is the era where, you know, nowadays stuff like this happens and it's, you know, pretty much forgotten in a week. Not in this era.
Even if you have the wall-to-wall coverage, it's still forgotten.
Stuff lasted.
Yes, and I remember this was the lead story on Entertainment Tonight one day this week, and they photoshopped, or whatever you would have done that would have been the equivalent of photoshopping at the time, Tanya Harding with Bull Nakano's face paint and hair.
So did she ever actually train?
She never actually wrestled.
I think the probation just precluded anything from happening, right?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, in America, I know she appeared on like a couple. Didn't she appear on like one or two Northwest shows and one or two AAA shows?
Well, it was AAA in conjunction with Sandy Barr.
Yeah.
Okay. But those were as valets. Is there any proof that she actually tried to train in a ring with anyone?
No, she never did.
And then the felony made it that the notorious Oregon Commission, or was it actually, was that show in Washington or Oregon? It was Oregon,
Portland.
Right?
It was Portland.
Oh, it was Portland, okay. And Sandy Barr booked like what was it, like a 3,000 seat
fairground? It's on YouTube.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. He booked like what, a 3,000 seat fairgrounds or something?
Yeah.
Drew like 300 people or whatever.
Yeah, and you know,
what I was saying though was that she couldn't sit ringside because of the felony.
Yeah,
she had to stand on the ramp.
And there's a film being in the process of being made now about her, where Margot Robbie, the female lead from Wolf of Wall Street, is will portray Tanya.
And if she had any aptitude for it, she probably would have been good though, because she was a hell of an athlete.
And she could cut a promo. Nancy Kerrigan couldn't cut promos, so Tanya Harding could.
She still can.
Yeah.
You saw that 30 for 30.
Yeah, so that would have been wild. We're seeing some stuff here, though, Biggs. AJW trying to get on television in the United States. Where have we talked about this before between the Chiefs? Japanese wrestling organizations trying to get television in the United States.
Also, aren't we just past the whole Howard Brody Ring Warriors trying to get TV in the States thing?
Yes. $2 million for one match in 1994. That's insane money. Because I think the highest by that point was 800,000 Bix.
In Japan or in general?
In general.
What was believed to be the highest payoff left to that point? WrestleMania 3?
Yeah, I think something like that. $800,000 or something like that. But insanity. And All Japan, they eventually did run that dome show on November 10th, didn't they?
Of course they did. Big Egg Universe.
That's right. So
which was somehow several hours longer than this year's WrestleMania. And that, I'm not making that up.
Yeah. Now, they ran a semi-major show on April the 9th in Sendai with some LLPW women on it before 3,000 fans. As Yumiko Hata and Toshio Yamada beat Shinobu Kandori and Holly Saito as your main event. And then you had Aja Kong pinning, as what Dave calls her, the huge Reggie Bennett. And then you had Mima Shimoda retaining her Japanese title, pinning Miki Honda. But after the match, Shimoda returned the belt to the promotion, saying that she wanted to concentrate on her tag team with Itsuko Mita, who they just won the UWA tag titles, and had them unify the UWA tag titles with the WWWA tag titles held by Manami Toyota and Yamada. Now,
Tim, and LCO was not the most annoying tag team in wrestling. That would change several years later.
Yeah. T- Tim, you know, you talked about All Japan Women earlier. I mean, they were as hot in this time period, like in ring, as All Japan Men were.
Oh yeah. Yeah, that was some awesome stuff to get. And that was, it seemed to be a little easier to come by the commercial tapes from AJW where you could see a whole card.
Yeah,
well,
and
they would release the multi-tape sets and all that too, which I don't think any other promotion did they?
No, not that time.
Because they had the two tape set for Dream Rush, the two tape set for each Dream Slam, the four tapes. Was it four tapes for Big A Universe?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah,
yeah.
Either four or six. Yeah, I think it was four.
Now, Manami Toyota is somebody who, you know, the greatest wrestler ever project on PWO right now, person only. People that have rewatched her stuff, you know, have come to agreement that, you know, her stuff doesn't age as good as others do. And, you know, she falls in that line with some other people like Kurt Angle or maybe even Kobashi in some people's minds. I mean, what is your thought on Toyota, Tim? Do you think that she holds up, or do you think that, you know, that she's still, her matches still are great, or what are your thoughts about her matches?
Well, I haven't really rewatched any of the stuff, but I was always a huge fan of hers and got upset over all the criticism of people saying, you know, she was too spotty or whatever. But yeah, I don't know if I can really speak on that since I haven't rewatched it, but I participated in the tag team portion of that poll. And I remember sitting here debating where to rank her team with Yamada, given that they weren't really together all that long. And so I think that team and the LCO team were both on my list, though.
Yeah, they were a hell of a team, that's for sure. Now, going across groups here to JWP, and it looks like JWP has given up on Shigusa Nagayo as a drawing card. They spent all year putting Nagayo over the build to a Nagayo versus Dynamite Kansai main event for the JWP title on May 22nd at the 12,000-seat Araki Coliseum, which would be JWP's biggest show in its history. But on April 10th at Corkin Hall, Nagayo wrestled Devil Masami, who used her Lady Undertaker gimmick, and beat Nagayo with a sleeper in 28-38.
Now, wouldn't that Lady Undertaker gimmick be what she referred to as a super heel?
Yes, that would be it. It appeared going in that Nagayo would avenge her loss to Masami last year at Dream Slam 1, and coming up, the 49-second win over Cutie Suzuki would be established as Kansai's big contender. The next day, the promotion announced the main event had been changed to Kansai versus Aja Kong, and a battle of each group's champion. Kong beat Kansai to retain the WWWA title on All Japan show last year at August 25th at Budokan, so this may be time to return the favor. Bix, what do you think about this deal with Nagayo? They gave up on her. Why do you think? Why do you think this happened?
She just, until she reformed, when they did the Crush Girls feud in Gaia, and then when they reformed the team, it wasn't until then that during this comeback she really had like any like heat to her. You know what I mean? Like, she wasn't very good at the ring at this time. She just was there.
Yeah, I'd kind of forgotten until you mentioned her that she was even active during this time period. I thought she was kind of like out of sight, out of mind until Gaia got going.
Now, Tim, why don't you give a comparison to what JWP's standing in women's wrestling in Japan at that time was compared to All Japan Women, like in comparison to like, you know, American groups. How would you compare them as far
as?
Well,
it was the number two, at least. I'm not sure that about in 94, but certainly by a few years later, it was the
number
two. But
was it a WCW number two or a TNA number two? What do you say?
Probably closer to WCW than TNA, but that's a huge gap there.
Yeah, that's what I'm
saying. Not having gone to Japan until the year 2000, when it was already pretty much out of business, I can't really speak firsthand, but I would imagine that it was a fairly strong number two, but maybe not near in the same universe as far as fan perception. It's just my guess.
Well, honestly, you know what I would say the best comparison would be?
What's that?
There are differences in terms of ownership and how they're doing relative to the rest of the business at the time. I would say almost like the way New Japan and Noah are now, because they're so closely intertwined at the time. They're very reliant on the outside talent.
Yes.
I don't think there's a good comparison to that otherwise.
Yeah. Maybe a comparison would be AAA and EMLL in this era. In this era. Because AAA and AJW were the flashier promotions that were drawing the big houses, and the other groups were just, you know, steady along doing what they do.
But and it sounds like this is before the reboot. It sounds like that must have been 95 when they renamed everybody.
Yeah.
What was that? I'm trying to remember that. When did they? I mean, because there was some renaming when they did the when this version of JWP opened.
Well, at one point they renamed Amano and Kazumi, and there was like four girls.
Oh, Rico Amano becoming Carlos Amano.
Yes. Yes. And Azumi Hugo was formerly Kazumi or something, I think, maybe.
They did that a lot. That's the second time, at least, that they did that, right? Because there was the whole Miss A thing becoming Kansai, right?
Oh, I guess so, yeah.
Oh. Yeah, the renaming was weird, that's for sure. But, you know, I guess they had to do what they had to do to try to, you know,
yeah, I'm thinking that was 95 at the latest, because I know it was during the Smoky Mountain era, because when we would go down to Tennessee and spend time with Tim Whitehead, he had all kinds of Joshi merch and stuff.
Yeah.
He always had the conspiracy theory that, given that the Joshi business in particular was heavily merchandise driven, that that was their scheme to sell more merch, was rename people, so then people had to buy stuff again with the same girls.
Hey, smart.
If WWE has taught us anything, you just need to make a shirt a different color.
Oh, yeah, these days with for Cena. Sure. Yeah, these days for sure. All right.
Imagine if they just, if all of a sudden WWE just said, okay, here's Carlos Cena.
Or even just Juan Cena. On that note, we'll take a quick break and we'll let the Place B Boys pay the bills. And when we come back, we go to Mexico and go deep into the promotional wars. And AAA has found them a new partner.
Again.
We'll be back after this.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of the Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation, placetobenation.com. The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to the Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes at placetobenation.com. You can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current day wrestling with Main Event, Mission Indie Possible, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super Shows. And relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. We got sports covered too with the Sports Evolution Mega Show with Scott, Dr. G, Cowboy, and Cowboy Sr., the Kings of Sport led by Live Audio Wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, as well as the NBA Team Podcast and the TJ McClune Show. PTBN tackles pop culture and irreverence with Richard and the Mailman, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, and if you like a hybrid of all of this in list form, check out Jordan Duncan's Rank and File. All of these shows are available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Parv, and I'm here to tell you to listen and subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only Place to Be Nation Podcast Network. That's the PWO PTBN Podcast Network, where you'll find a ton of in-depth shows done by hardcore fans. We've got Chris Zellner's 1-2 Punch of Exile on Bad Street, and with David Bickerstaff, a smash hit Between the Sheets. We've got Wrestling Culture with Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave, Goodwill Wrestling and the Reaction Shows with Good Old Will from Texas. We've got This Week in Wrestling with my man Pete and Johnny Sorrow, Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston's Pro Wrestling Super Show, Tag Teams Back Again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze, and a ton of other great shows too. And of course there's Titans of Wrestling and Where the Big Boys Play with yours truly and some dude from down south called Chad. PWO PTBN Podcast Network.
And we're back, and let me thank everyone for listening to this show and the other great shows on the Place Be Nation, PWO Network, whatever you want to call it. So, go check all those shows out. Now, this is the time of the show where we get our plugs in. Well, not plugs, but a plug in, of course. The plug for our Amazon deal. As you go to tinyurl.com/BTSAmazon. For whenever you want to buy goods from Amazon.com, and you go through that link, and whenever you buy, we get a cut of the money, although you don't spend anything extra. No. So there's nothing extra comes out, and just a little bit goes to us in the end when you go through and add to your cart through that account, only through that account. I mean, not that account, through that link. Don't do it, and then they'll add to your cart before you go to that link. Add after you go to that link.
So, we know it's confusing, but.
Yeah, it's just the rules. It's the rules.
Yeah,
and if you don't want to go that route, you can always PayPal, Bix. And how do you do the PayPal for us?
Well, actually, yes. I just bought that big eBay lot of Wrestling Forum back issues for the show.
Yes, exactly. Yes, and your money is helping us, folks. We're getting research material for future shows.
Yes. So if you want to send me money for that, At first, I was going to give my PayPal.me, and I thought I had it set up for me to not get fees, but apparently, I do. So just send PayPal stuff then to davidbix@gmail.com. And
yes.
Just earmark that it's for the show, and it'll go towards that. We want to cover all of that just to and we also ordered a Matt Watch annual we were missing. And
yeah, we're
trying to get
research
as much of as possible. And then there's someone else who I know who has other wrestling forums. So we'll see what's in this lot, and then we'll try to fill in the gaps. And I wanted – who was the guy who sent me the first donation? Because I want to thank him. Okay.
You want to do it anonymously or
– I mean, I can't even find it right
well,
now.
Let's just say we had a generous donation this week, and we want to thank whoever you are. You are a listener. Thank you for that. It's highly appreciated.
You are a listener like you are fight.
Yeah, exactly. So you know who you are. So we definitely appreciate you. And if anybody else wants to do the same, if they feel like that's the route they want to go, then go ahead, you know.
But
it all goes to a good cause.
And the more you send, the more 80s episodes you can expect, it seems like.
Yes,
because
we're trying to fill 80s gaps and even early 2000s gaps. We can get that handled for Wrestling Observers and stuff like that. So
have you ever read Wrestling Forum? I have not, but everyone keeps telling me it was the strong number two behind the Observer until Matt Watch and Torch came along.
Never seen an issue. So it's all
who wrote that?
John Gallagher and Sean Grande.
Sean Grande, who is the play-by-play boy, so the Boston Celtics.
And now Bellator replacing former Between the Sheets guest.
Yeah.
Sean Wheelock, unfortunately.
Sean Wheelock,
he's actually done a good job adjusting, but he's no Wheelock.
No, Sean, we lost a great, great announcer. All right, so plug time's out of the way for now. We'll get more later on. But let's go to Mexico, as we always do after the break. And AAA, and big news going on here. On April 5th, UWA combined with AAA to run interpromotional matches at its regular weekly shows in Pachuca and Querétaro. In Pachuca, they drew a nearly sellout house, which was the largest crowd for UWA in SC in almost 3 years. That was at Arena Aficion, I guess. Connect, Dos Caras, and Scorpio Jr. went over Los Hermanos, Dinamita, Cien Caras, Mascaraña 2000, and Universo 2000 by DQ, of course, when Cien hit Connect with a low blow, because God forbid we have clean pinfall finishes. On that show, regardless of who were the faces and heels, the crowd was vocally behind the UMBA wrestlers in every match. In the semi-main, we had AAA Technicos, Rey Mysterio Jr., Winners, and Volador. Awesome team. Go to a draw against UWA heels Carlos Legarde Jr., Shuo Guerrero, and Príncipe Maya. Mysterio's daredevil work was such that the partisan UWA crowd finally broke down and gave him polite applause. In Querétaro, they drew a half house to see UWA Rudos, Villano Tercero, El Signo, and Masacre, who just jumped from EMLL when offered, in addition to a wrestling spot and office job as the head of UWA's public relations. And they went over AAA Technicos, Conan, Latin Lover, and Io Dos Santos. That's a strong technical team. When Signo pinned Lover after a foul. Although Conan got some cheers by the end of the match, The crowd was solidly pro-UWA in every match, seeing this as a promotion versus promotion deal. Now, the AAA wrestlers are scheduled to start when UWA goes back to his Sunday shows at El Torreo de Cuatro Caminos after the upcoming election, because the Torreo is being used every Sunday for political rallies, with the first show set for April 17th, which will be a tag team tournament involving teams from both offices. This deal was put together because UWA crowds had dropped to the point that there was serious concern. There was serious concern that the company would last the summer, and an interpersonal deal was one thing that could save it. Antonio Pena agreed to the deal, which had been reported as a signed deal in the papers, although it was just a verbal deal as opposed to a contract. But Pena felt in the early stages it would be important to put the UWA wrestlers over for credibility purposes. Amazing concept there. UWA guys wouldn't be appearing right now in AAA television, although eventually there are plans to do an angle that will lead to some of them appearing, probably a Japanese-style angle, where some UWA wrestlers show up in street clothes at a AAA taping and disrupt things and issue challenges. Wow, this is ahead of the game, isn't it? The whole thing will most likely lead to a title versus title match with Conan, who won the IWC heavyweight title on April 2nd in Reynosa from Cien Caras against Connect. Now, Tim, the guys in street clothes supposed to be representing the rival organization showing up and disrupting things at the TV taping in 1994? I thought in 1996 that was an original idea.
I don't think they saw Mexican stuff.
Well, Bischoff was, which will be talked about later in the show, he was talking with AAA at this time.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, of course, this is the NWO, you know, situation where, you know, they debuted in the street clothes and disrupted the TV tapings. And it was betrayed as this whole original thing. Folks, it was not original. Not in the slightest.
Right. It was Greg Gagne's idea.
It was Greg Gagne's idea that would have saved
them. I thought it was Mike Graham's.
It was Greg Gagne's idea that was going to have the AWA saved by WGN. But,
you mentioned earlier on, who did winners end up being, or wieners?
Abismo Negro.
Okay.
Yeah, and of course, Volador is Super Parka, Volador Jr.'s father. And Rey Mysterio Jr. is still Rey Mysterio Jr., and he's still damn awesome. So, you know, and Big, you look at these matches, I mean, this is a big deal to have the UWA guys and AAA guys going against it. I mean, yeah, UWA was pretty dead, but still, those were name guys. Connect, Dos Caras were big, big names. You know, Viano Tercero, still a big name. So it's a big deal to have these guys against the AAA guys.
This revived them for the last time. They did well for a while with this whole double power thing with AAA.
Yeah, it's double power, yeah.
And then it just, there were issues, as there always are.
Of course.
And it just, and then it ran a scene. Then UWA kind of stuck around, technically.
Yeah.
Longer? Not really, but technically.
Well, you know what the biggest gift to come out of this feud was?
What?
Cibernetico.
That's right.
Cibernetico was a UWA young boy. He was a guy that Connect was bringing along. And he eventually, after this, just stayed AAA and became one of their biggest stars of the last 20 years.
What a record Connect has with mentoring guys. Cibernetico, Gronda, and Gefahr. Yeah.
And all of them work the same as Connect.
Oh, well, come on. Connect was at least better than them.
Yeah, somewhat.
He's better enough to be embarrassed by them.
Yeah. Yeah, but this is just a Hail Mary plan.
But by the way, for those who don't know, that's one of the great pro wrestling stories ever. So after CMLL put Ultimo Guerrero and Rey Bucanero with El Satanico as the Infernales with the idea that it would get them over, and then they'd mix in Tarzan Boy, and it would get all these guys, and it worked. It worked perfectly.
Great feud.
So that whole thing with new Infernales and the split, and then the Guerrero solo Infernario. Okay, so Antonio Pena sees that, and he's like, I need to do that, which is fair enough. So he takes Kinect, and he puts him with Gronda and Gefahr. Gronda, I would hope people listening to the show or at least have a passing familiarity with who or what Gronda was.
Yeah, Gafar, though, you gotta describe.
Gafar is... Picture Gronda, but probably not as yoked up, but still a big, thick guy wearing a padded demon outfit of some kind. Would that be a way to put it?
Yeah, put Gafar Lucha into your Google image search.
G-H-E-F-A-R. Gafar was like the kaiju big battle version of Gronda.
Yes. All right,
spell that again. I'm not familiar with that.
G-H-E-F-A-R. Gafar. The sad thing was Gafar actually eventually got kind of good.
Yeah.
It way too late. Whereas Gronda, every time he took a bump, would have a giant bruise on his chest.
And then would just break his leg at random times. Or suffer severe injuries.
And then, of course, he became...
This guy's like the most jacked Giant Gonzalez.
Yes!
And then, of course, Gronda went to CMLL as Groon Triple X.
Yeah, and now he works as Gronda Triple X. On the indie scene, and he's not nearly as big as he was. He's still a big guy, but he's not nearly as big as he was. He's lost. He's like Triple H.
And
he's cut, but he's not big.
And Triple H is still big though. He's just not as big as he was. And CLL Groon had the greatest entrance music of all time, which was a mix of Hawk saying "Oh What a Rush" and the Ultimate Warrior's WWF entrance music over and over.
The best of both worlds there. All right. Anyway, moving on.
If you have never seen Gronda, for the love of God, look him up.
Oh, yeah. Now, La Briosa and Neftali won the vacant Mexican National Feminine Tag Titles on April the 6th in Tecojo, defeating Vicky Carranza and La Rosa on a show main evented by, and this sounds like a hell of a match, Psicosis, defeating Heavy Metal to retain his WWA welterweight title. Yeah, now that sounds awesome. Now, the next show in Los Angeles isn't scheduled until August the 6th. The reason being given is that the sports arena doesn't have any open dates on the weekends until then, although that is hard to believe, since the sports arena sits empty most of the summer.
Hmm. Now, I believe August 6th was the show that they ended up running headlined by Mascarita versus Espectrito mask match?
Yes.
Which did not do as well as expected.
No. No. And speaking of not doing well as expected, we go to the other side, MLL. A lot of the wrestlers are upset that Miguel Perez Jr. and Yamato, of course, Yamato is Tiger Chung Lee, also known as Kim Duck and whatever other gimmicks.
Oh, my God.
Brought in from UWA.
In 1994.
Yes. We're brought in from UWA because this group has more than 200 wrestlers on a contract, only four of whom are on a guarantee. And the rest are paid by the show, and there are enough shows in the week to give most of them regular work. A few years ago, before television, it used to be that this group would have more than a dozen house shows in Mexico City area alone on certain nights, but now they are down to 15 to 20 shows per week. Now, Perez looks to be a Rudo feuding with the Canadian Vampire, or as we know him, Vampiro. Now, Corazon
you mean Canadian Vampire Casanova.
Yes, and Corazon de Leon is back for a few weeks teaming with Vampiro. Of course, Corazon de Leon is the dad bod himself, Chris Jericho. Now his
buddy has heat with the – did you see that? With our good friend and my 605 co-host, the great Ryan Last.
Yes. Now, yeah, I mean
– over Jericho. Jericho induced heat.
Yeah. Now, yeah, the roster was so huge. It's big now, but it was so huge in this era. And think about that, a dozen house shows on certain nights in Mexico City.
Now, when Dave says that, Derek, does he mean EMLL promoted shows or shows with EMLL talent?
The latter.
Okay.
Yeah, and they don't promote. The only shows they promote are in their buildings.
And again, their buildings. So we
Arena
are,
Mexico,
Arena Coliseo, Mexico City, Arena Puebla,
and Arena Coliseo Guadalajara.
Okay, that's what I thought.
So if you see,
were there more in 94?
Oh, yeah. Pista Revolucion was another building that they ran. That was like their third building in Mexico City. But that was really the only other one. Every other one was Spot Show Promotion.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, there were so many guys in the contract. I mean, it's just insane. But, you look at Miguel Perez Jr. Yamato. That's two guys as far as like career trajectories on the farthest side from each other right there, Bix.
When I read that, I'm like, wait, who's Yamato? And then you said, I'm like, come on. Why are you even going to bring him in? At all?
I think just to steal him from UWA. I don't know.
Well, bravo.
And of course, Miguel Perez Jr. being Puerto Rican, you know, that's it plays into the whole xenophobia deal.
And he has to be, or he has to be ill because of that. And
yeah,
it's too bad they can't have the pictures of him. Then.
Did y'all see the picture of him at WrestleCon?
With Miguel Jr.?
Yeah, I totally would not have recognized him.
Why did he shave his body?
Yeah, his whole head is shaved.
That's not what I asked.
Right. Well,
did he shave his body hair?
He was clothed, so I have no idea.
Well, I mean, you may.
Well, you better check with your sources and find out then.
Miguel was a great talent at one point. I mean, the guy could work. He doesn't get his due.
Yeah, it's, you know, people didn't like watching a guy doing cool high spots in a sweater.
Yeah, he didn't care like Dutch Mantel did, that's for sure.
No, I wonder if it
was. Oh, you beat me to the Dutch reference.
I knew you were heading that way, Tim, so I had to get it in.
Let's rank them. Robert Gibson, Dutch Mantel.
Robert Gibson wasn't that hairy.
Oh, okay, well he's often mentioned in their company.
He's not that hairy. There was another Pampiro Ferpo.
Yes, Bull Curry.
Bull Curry. Dutch is obvious number one, right, Tim? I mean, he's the best hairy wrestler.
Oh yeah,
by far.
I'm sure there's some certain YouTube channels that would be partial to Mark Fleming
and Dale Veazey.
Killer Kyle,
great call. Yes, yes, definitely. Now we're still in EMLL as they're talking about bringing in the Barbarian as a Rudo and turning King Haku to be his partner.
How did this not happen?
Now think about that, Tim. The future powers of pain together in Mexico.
In the Faces of Fear.
Well, Mexico, excuse me, in Mexico. How great would that
be? Faces of Fear is what I
said. That's what I said, Face of Fear.
You said Powers of Pain.
I corrected myself.
Okay.
But think about that, though, Tim, in Mexico. I mean, that would have been a monster act there because they would have just dominated everybody in the country.
One Haku was over.
Was this before or after war SWS era?
This was during war.
Okay. Yeah, yep. So why not? They've already been everywhere else.
Yeah, I mean, that. Watching Barbarian do lucha spots, I mean, that would have been awesome.
Was this Antler era Barbarian?
This is after. This is Barbarian indies.
This is right before he went to WWF as Sione.
Yeah, right before he became a head shrinker. Which was weird. But, yeah, and this is right before. That would have been just cool.
Those guys randomly worked a Virginia indie show as the head shrinkers during that era.
Well, because he could book guys from The Office, right? That point, couldn't you?
Pretty much.
Yeah. An odd choice, considering not a lot of them showed up on indie shows at this point as much as they would in, like, what would you say, like 96, 97?
Yeah.
But, so that kind of a surprising choice then, but whatever.
Yeah. Now,
I got to mention for a second. Barbarian is one of my favorite thing from Tim's old tape list. On that, a Peach State Wrestling show? Where he does a headbutt off the top rope through a table on the floor. I remember seeing...
Oh, that's a Greg Price show, All-Star Wrestling.
Oh, okay. I remember you running the clip when you did, like, the 5 years of wrestling power shows. And then I remember seeing it on your list, and all you... And what the note was just, Barbarian gets hardcore.
He's a guy that would have been... I mean, he could have been in ECW. I mean, that... It's amazing how that guy didn't get more work in this era before he went to WWE. The guy was good.
mean, he's approaching his peak as a worker before his body kind of broke down.
Yeah. Now, Zoti Hamada, daughter of Grand Hamada and wife of Silver King, is out of action as she's expecting about 3 months into the pregnancy. And, of course, that kid is now wrestling as Silver King Jr. So there we go.
Yeah.
I was actually going to ask you if the kid was wrestling.
Yes, it's Silver King Jr. Yeah.
And by the way, I should add, anyone who wants to understand why we always talk up the Barbarian, go to the network, go watch The Barbarian versus Eddie Guerrero from Nitro in 96.
Or watch Barbarian versus Manny Fernandez matches. Or there's a good Barbarian versus Man MTA match from World Championship Wrestling in January 1986 on the network.
That's so good, but I would say Barbarian versus Eddie Guerrero from Nitro, Faces of Fear versus Sting and Luger from the same time on Nitro, Barbarian versus Bossman from Royal Rumble 91, too.
Yeah.
And Barbarian and Haku versus The Rockers from WrestleMania 7.
Yes. Now, we're going to stay in the...
Do we know how long this relationship lasted? I never knew Silver King was connected to the Hamada family.
I don't remember that either.
I don't know how long it lasted, but yeah. The Hamada family has a lot of tie-ins in Mexico.
Yes. This is post-Negro Casas, right?
Yeah, yes.
Ayako dated her fair share of wrestlers as well.
Oh, yes. Yeah, she has a laundry list. Now, Canada, as we stay in North America.
You cut me off for making a joke about how we won't talk about how the Sochi Negro Casas marriage ended.
Go ahead.
No, I said that we're not going to talk about it.
Okay. Well, Negro Casas.
Before or after this one?
Before.
Before.
Okay.
Well, Negro Casas, he has a reputation that way. He has his type. Let's put it that way. Him and Jim Barnett have some things in common.
Okay, so it's not this Ric Flair type. We're talking something different.
No, it's the Jim Barnett type.
Well,
I see.
For all I know, he could have had a type. They could have still had that in common with Flair.
Let's just say.
I told you I didn't want to say. God damn it.
So I'm going to say two words.
No, we don't have to say it.
Ricky Marvin. That's all I'm going to say. All right, in Canada. In Winnipeg, the old West 4 Wrestling Alliance changed its name to International Wrestling Alliance.
So this is officially our North American International section.
Yes. And at its first TV taping on April the 5th, using, among others, FMW's Dr. Luther and Big Titan Rick Bogner. Now, wasn't Don Callis part of this group too, Bix?
He was the booker.
That's right.
They put on some really good TV from 94 to 95.
Yeah, entertaining as shit.
And just not a lot of people saw it.
Yeah.
Let's think about who was there. Yeah, Don Callis. He had really good matches with guys like Rick Martel and Jim Brunzel. I think around this period it was more Martel. He had Lance Storm, Jericho, Ultimate Dragon would come in for shots, Dr. Luther. Am I forgetting anyone? Rick Titan. I feel like I'm forgetting someone. Who else was around then? But he would show war tapes on the show, Callis would, and he booked it. He produced very good TV.
Lozansky?
Yes, I think Mike Lozansky was around. Because he was part of that crew.
Yeah. So, yeah, it was fun stuff that just doesn't get talked about a lot.
It took some obvious cues from ECW, but it was very much its own thing.
Yeah. Now,
you would agree with that? I think that's the best way to put it.
Yeah. Tim, do you ever see any of that stuff?
Just whatever Lance Storm released from he and Jericho's stuff, which probably would have been right before this, I guess, because they were getting ready to come into Smokey about this time, I guess.
There's a lot on YouTube now.
There's a lot on YouTube now. So, yeah. If you haven't seen it, go check it out. Now, in another group.
It would be both WFWA and IWA Hardcore Canada were the two names.
Yeah. Now, you go to British Columbia, and they got a lot of things going on here. There's a riot on April the 8th for West Coast Championship Wrestling in Qualkin Beach, British Columbia. Apparently, the crowd consisted largely of intoxicated students. And when Michelle Starr, who was doing a gay gimmick, and Adrian Balboa came out for their main event match.
Who was
a guy. I don't know. They were bombarded with cans, cups, and everything else. It couldn't be calmed down. So the show had to be canceled before the main event began. In British Columbia, which if you remember, hey, I will say this for BC. When Vancouver won the Stanley Cup a few years ago, they had one of the biggest riots I've seen of a sports yes. team fan base winning a championship. So,
how far from Vancouver would this Qualkin Beach place be?
Oh, let's see. Qualkin Beach, British Columbia. I'm sure Morrow would know if he was here. That's his neck of the woods. Qualkin Beach and Vancouver. It looks like it's near Vancouver. Okay.
So think about that. Does this really, with everything we know about Vancouver, does any of this really surprise?
Yeah, it's on the it's near the Vancouver beaches. So yeah, it's not
against anyone we know from Vancouver, but considering all the things that have happened with Vancouver and the government mandated red light district and
there's a reason why Hollywood like to tape a lot of television and movies and stuff.
I thought that was for tax reasons.
Well, that's one of them, but there's other reasons too. Now Michelle Starr worked forever.
Yeah, so
Michelle Starr was working for ECCW in the 2000s.
And he was never really any good.
No, he wasn't.
No, he was not at the level of, say, a Diamond Timothy Flowers or a J.R. Bundy.
Or Ole Olsen, maybe.
Buddy Wayne.
Of course, but not the great Buddy Wayne of Memphis.
No, would we say he's better or worse than Chico Alvarez?
I'd say better.
Really?
Yeah.
You would say what? You would say Michelle Starr is better than Chico Alvarez?
Oh, you're talking about? I said Buddy Wayne.
No.
Chico.
Okay.
And now let's go to ECW, or this time still Eastern Championship Wrestling.
NWA Eastern Championship Wrestling.
That's right. The Torch reported that Eric Bischoff has met with Todd Gordon recently about working together regarding promoting the Slammer pay-per-view in Philly in May. Bischoff told Todd that he would let them use some WCW talent, and he would spotlight ECW talent on his TV, but ECW booker Paul Heyman wants nothing to do with WCW. Heyman said there is nothing they could offer him to make him associate with them. He went on to say they had the greatest talent around, have no idea what to do with him.
Well, that would change.
Bischoff and Todd Gordon, huh? That's, where will we hear that again?
What wasn't Between the Sheets' favorite Terry Taylor involved with that?
Kind of, sort of. Now,
funny how New Jack wasn't one of the people that the Mole tried to bring in.
Hey, we'll talk about him later. So he comes up later on the show. What this led to, Tim, was it led to Arn Anderson and Bobby Eaton going to ECW. And that was a big deal at the time for them.
That was huge.
Yeah. And we had just seen Arn and Bobby in Smoky Mountain the year before doing the same type of deal.
Yeah, how creative on Paulie's part.
So, I mean, yeah, that was a question I was going to ask. I was thinking to myself, Tim, do you think Paul was just basically ripping Cornette's gimmick off completely here with him?
It's possible, but they didn't bring him in anywhere near. It's not like there was a guy in a sheet involved.
Oh, no. It wasn't nowhere near as great and fun as the Smoky Mountain was. In fact, who was Arn's partner, Bix? Was it Terry Funk?
Yes.
And then Eaton's was Sabu, or was it
Sabu,
Shane?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Sabu, that's right.
That was the first live ECW show I went to.
Oh, really? All right. Yeah. What did you think about that, going there for the first time?
Oh, it was awesome. But, you know, at that point, it really, I don't know that they had the reputation they had. You know, they were still building their reputation at that point. But it was definitely, it was like a cult, I guess, at that point. Because we knew people that lived further away than us that made the religious trek up there every 3 weeks.
Now, this was at the arena, right? Not the sports bar?
Right, yeah.
Okay. Now, the thing here, Bix, is if you have never seen Slamboree 1994, A, you need to watch the show. It's one of the best WWE pay-per-views of that era. And B, the crowd is so awesome in that show because it is the ECW crowd.
So and Funk was on there, right?
Yeah, and Funk was on the show, and they were doing ECW stuff. You had ECW signs. I mean,
Hat guy front and center with Terry Funk.
Hat guy was all over. Terry Funk took his hat. Stuff about Joey Styles. I mean, they took over the show, and it made for a fun ass fucking show.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good. I mean, well, they had two great pay per views in a row.
Spring Stampede, which would be the week after this one we're talking about, and then that one. And of course, this one had the legendary Kevin Sullivan, Cactus Jack versus Nasty Boys, Philly Street Fight with Dave Schultz, not Dr. D. David Schultz, but Dave Schultz, the Philadelphia
Flyer.
As the amateur wrestler, Max Payne coming out with a guitar. I mean, just great stuff.
Absolutely destroying Brian Knobs with a guitar.
Oh, my God. Killed him. So if you
that is the greatest / worst guitar shot in the history of professional wrestling.
Yes, go watch that show because Jesse was still announcing. It was Jesse and Tony on this show, if I'm not mistaken.
Was it the whole show, or he only did part of the show?
I think Jesse did the whole show, didn't he?
I'm not sure.
But anyway, go check it out if you haven't seen it.
And was the first show was Bash at the Beach the first one where he only did part of the show? Or maybe
I think Bash
did
Bash.
Well, he might have done it for the Clash too, but
we did play by play at Spring Stampede. But it was a fun show, and it's one of those things where I think that if WCW ECW would have got their shit together, they could have had a really great working relationship with each other.
In reality, they were going for the same audience.
Yeah, WWE had Smokey and had Memphis, so WCW and ECW would have been great to work with each other, but. Another guy's coming in soon, and that wasn't going to happen on his watch. We'll talk about that later. Anyway, let's go to Smoky Mountain Wrestling, speaking of. And they had a fun television show this week. It's on television. Tammy Sitch, or as she's known this time, Tammy Fitch, complained of Ricky Morton kissing her on last week's show on the mouth. And she complained about it. And she said that she was going to sue the promotion for sexual battery and sexual harassment. And that she might get AIDS or cooties from kissing him. And I think we have this, Bix.
AIDS
not?
Or cooties?
Yes.
Well, actually, yes. So I need to figure. So how far into the show is this?
But you have to be prepared. You got to be prepared.
Not for this show.
We're trying to be somewhat professional here. Come on. We try to be.
Okay. Well, talk about Tammy Fitch for a second. Oh, did you see in Fighting Spirit that now we know the story behind the fit name change from Sitch to Fitch?
Yeah, you told it on the show.
Oh, I did. Okay.
Yeah. And this is the beginning of the feud, or right near the beginning of the Rock and Rolls versus Candido and Brian Lee feud, which, we talked about on Exile on Bass Street and the Smoky Mountain Wrestling show.
Oh, is this Down and Dirty with Dutch?
Should be.
Okay.
It's her promo.
I got it.
She gets her little ugly butt out here. She can have her singles match.
You're talking about Dirty White Girl.
If she comes out here, she can have.
Is this what leads to? Is this a recap of the kiss, though?
I'm guessing it's somewhere in there. It was on that show.
So should we just go with it?
Well, we're going to talk about Dirty White Girl anyway.
Okay.
The single match that she wants.
If she comes out.
I don't think she's going to come.
That's a very important announcement, and I like to say, wait a minute, we're joined here. Okay, wait just a minute. Okay, you heard the challenge. All right, you got any words?
Hey, it ain't nothing for me to slap that broad senseless. I want her right now.
Okay, wait a minute. Okay.
Kimberly.
She said it ain't nothing to her to slap your face or something like that. She wants you right now.
Wait a minute. I think you may have misunderstood me. Singles match with me. I didn't say with me.
Oh, wait a minute.
That's Peggy Lee Leather without Bambi.
Hey, I'm getting sick and tired of people interrupting Down and Dirty. Wait a minute. Tammy, excuse me, I gotta break this up.
Was gonna break it up.
She body slams him. Let me find it. Okay, so then is this the right promo then?
Maybe.
Where she has Peggy with her?
I guess.
Okay.
Well, you threw out the challenge, a dirty white girl accepted it, but it wasn't you.
You know, it's coming. It's coming. The ladies showdown is coming up. Dirty white girl wanted a match. She got her match. You know, I can't even understand why they're calling this a ladies showdown, because the dirty white girl certainly isn't a lady, and Peggy Lee Leather's not really much of a lady either. I mean, she brawled.
And she's shaking her head no while Peggy is, while Tammy says this.
She cusses and she even drinks beer. This is great. She's the greatest. Dirty white girl, Peggy Lee Leather is going to break you in half. Right, Peggy?
You know, Tammy, I'm glad you gave me a call. You know why? Because I like to hurt people. I make a career out of going all over the world wrestling, annihilating little people like this little dirty white girl. Who does she think she is to get in a square circle? She don't know how to wrestle. She don't even know how to put on wrestling boots. I tell you what, when me and you get in that ring, I'm going to squat you like a little gnat. You're going down. And me and you are going to go out and drink some beer. Ha!
We'll be back, fans, right after we take this time out.
Tammy's facial expressions this year are just tremendous.
I guess that you don't have that then, the Ricky Morton deal.
I don't know. I'm looking. Although we have Daryl Van Horn cutting off Prince Karras's thumb.
Oh, please play that. Okay. Please play that. Please play that.
I want to welcome you to my segment. My special guest right now. Everybody give him a big round of applause, please. Daryl Van Horn and Prince Karras. Let me tell you right now, Mr. Horn, pleasure to have you on the program. And I...
Mr. Horn?
No, you have some words of wisdom to all the fans of Smoky Mountain.
That's right. As I told the world, Prince Karras is now finally getting his due. He's getting his Smoky Mountain Championship match with the dirty white boy. I've taken a lot of preparations to make sure that the prince is comfortable. I told you that we brought in more Nubian virgins, manservants, and the rest to make sure that he's at his most comfortable for this match. In fact, I have even brought in some of Prince Karras's native soil so that he may be more at home, the soil that brings him power, the sand of the Nile. Now, dirty white boy, I've been talking for months about Prince Karras getting a title shot, and now you think you seem to be under the impression that you can do the impossible, what nobody else has been able to do, defeat Prince Karras. Well, you better guess again. He can't be hurt. When he gets done with you, you'll be turning tricks for some chicken hawk on the streets of San Francisco, and the dirty white girl will go back to her old job as the primary test subject for the Monistat Corporation.
So now, fucking awesome.
For the non-believers, you understand, Dutch, there are those people who say that Prince Karras is not who I say he is. Karras... Usta la mea chakia no sia toata. Usta la mea salateasa. Now, I would like for you people to watch this. You think you can hurt this man? I'm proving a point, Dutch. I am proving a point. Watch this! You think you can hurt this dirty white boy? You stupid cracker! You think you can hurt Prince Karras? Guess again, you clown! Not a chance in hell!
So for those of you who can't see this, he used garden shears to cut off Prince Karras's thumb, and sand is coming out.
Now, is that it for the audio part?
No, there's more.
Okay, keep it on.
Shut up! Who do you honestly think that you're trying to fool around here? You trying to get people to believe that this big piece of toilet paper is 3,000 years old? Well, I don't buy it. Now, granted, he's a big man. He looks like he stands about 6'9", about 350 pounds. But I specialize in big men, so I'm not worried about him. And as far as you're concerned... I dare you. No, I take that back. I double dog dare you to get a hat instead of that flower pot you got on your head.
It's his.
Let me tell you something. Hey, you don't put your hands on me And B, I'm going to tell you something that everybody around here has been wanting to tell you for a long time, but couldn't. Shut up! Hey!
Karras went after him, but he missed him, Dutch.
Take it, Bob. I'm out of here.
The dirty white boy and Prince Karras go at it, and Karras goes down from a big right hand, and then you saw Daryl Van Horn throw something, some of that sand or whatever it was, right into the face and the eyes of the dirty white boy. And now there's that arm again. There's something about that arm. What's with that? The big guy twists or turns that arm, Dutch, and then he just clobbers an opponent with it. It's got to be...
Amazing. And
I think I found the Tammy problem, by the way.
Okay.
Let's see. Oh, wait, is this a flashback? Let's see. Oh, wait, no, this might be it. Okay, I think this is it.
Okay.
When he tries to get into the ring and the referee gets...
This is Brian Lee and Chris Candido against Rock and Roll.
A desperation
move by Ricky Morton.
Now
popping.
We're going to see Morton now can make the tag, get to the corner, guys. Rolls a somersault in the corner. Here comes Gibson.
Okay, first man in. Prime time, Brian Lee and Candido level. Their heads together, looks like yes.
And they both go down, or at least prime time Brian Lee goes down, and Candido staggers around in the ring. Now they got Morton. Candido clothesline Lee.
Double drop kick.
Wait a minute. What's happening? The referee's tied up over in the corner.
Wait a minute. Tammy Fitch is in the ring.
What's she doing?
Tammy Fitch is in the ring. Ricky Morton's got her. And he's kissing her. That's a sexual battery. Look what he's doing.
Kissing Tammy Fitch when she got into the ring from behind.
He kissed her.
Candido slugged him with a pocketbook.
1, 2, 3. We got a winner here, and it's Lee and Candido over the Rock and Roll.
See, we showed who the best team is. The best team is Chris Candido and Primetime Brian Lee. They're my boys. They are the best team. They beat up the Rock and Roll Express. Everybody saw it. But you know, I'm going to go file sexual assault charges because Ricky Morton took me and he forcibly kissed me and I can get like cooties or AIDS or some other disease like that. Chris, why did he do that to me?
Let me tell you something. The reason Ricky Morton did that, he couldn't even get a date on a tombstone. Me and Brian Lee proved who the greatest tag team in professional wrestling was when we put the Rock and Roll down, 1, 2, 3. And Brian, I'm going to tell you in front of everybody, you are the reason why.
Well, Chris, I'm not one to blow my own horn, but thanks for telling me anyway. I'll tell you what.
Thank you, Arn Anderson.
Said it better. I am the man of the team. I am the big dog. You see that? Chris, look at these guns. Look at these guns.
Brian Lee is the worst.
But, Tim... We did the 3 shows of Smoky Mountain Wrestling. God, this TV was so awesome. And all these great talkers, Tammy, Daryl Van Horn, of course, Jim Cornette, who will play in a few minutes. Just so many great talkers in this promotion.
Yeah, and I guess she's not worried about cooties anymore.
Oh, my Lord, right? And God, Tammy.
Well, they test for everything else, but I guess they can't test for cooties.
1994, Tammy, I would have never... seen. I never would have thought that she would become what she became. She was so
but
awesome.
But I'm sure a lot of people listening in are like, that's her? Because her voice has changed so much.
I know. It's crazy, especially if you've done Skype chats with her. I mean, it's crazy, man, to see how much she's changed. God.
No awesome. Farting here.
Oh. But Daryl Van Horn, of course. I mean, that promo there. And we talk about on a show... On the Exile shows, being somebody from North Carolina or Virginia or South Carolina, you're watching this and this guy's talking about chicken hogs in San Francisco turning tricks, talking about the Monistat Corporation. Just God.
Well, you know what the best one was, though?
Belching the family dog. I mean, God, what a great, great character that was. Oh, great, great stuff. All right. The last 7 minutes of this television show, though, it aired the last few minutes of the Lose Leave Town match between the Rock and Roll Express and the Heavenly Bodies from Pikeville, Kentucky. And then it had an incredible interview by Jim Cornette and a short music video, which may be the best 7 minutes of wrestling television this year, according to Dave Meltzer. Wrestling is about stirring emotion, and it really doesn't take a ton of money to produce television that accomplishes that purpose. All the money in the world can't buy it, though, if you don't understand how to do it. And Bix, I think we have this ready.
Straight to Cornette's promo, not the rock and roll promo?
Straight to Cornette.
Okay, here we go.
I wonder what's taking so long, Kevin. They've been in here for a good little while. I don't know what.
Meeting's breaking up, and Cornette is not happy.
Hi, fans. I'm Brian Matthews on assignment for Smoky Mountain Wrestling today.
Rest in peace, Brian Matthews. Fourth,
and inside this door, the Smoky Mountain Wrestling Board of Directors
He's dead.
Has had an emergency meeting call. Jim Cornette
Indeed.
And the Heavenly Bodies are in the room with the Board
and
of Directors.
So was his friend.
Pleading their case in the outcome of the Loser Leave Smoky Mountain Wrestling match that took place on April 1st, just a few days ago, at the Bluegrass Brawl 2 in Pikeville, Kentucky. Now, we should be finding out shortly, if the meeting is breaking up, we should be finding out shortly about the outcome and see what's happened with the Heavenly Bodies in pleading their case. And Mr. Cornette, apparently...
Well, I gotta look at you everywhere I go!
Apparently, you're not very pleased with this outcome.
God, I can't believe this! Bob Armstrong is like a thorn in our side! Oh, God, him and the board of directors, Tom, God almighty.
Listen, it's just like the old saying goes, when you're the leaders of the pack and you think you got that rat race licked, they just go out and find bigger and faster rats. And if you want to talk about the biggest rats,
Jimmy Del Rey is my rat.
Wrestling, let's talk about the Rock and Roll Express and Bob Armstrong. I have been ripped off, Jimmy Del Rey has been ripped off, and Jim Cornette has been ripped off. The Heavenly Bodies can no longer stay in Smoky Mountain Wrestling, and this is not right. It's a conspiracy.
Mr. Cornette, your thoughts on the outcome?
Just like I thought it would be. It's a waste of time to come over here because I know what Bob Armstrong's got on his mind. I know what the board of directors, they've waited for this chance. They've waited for it for a long time, and now they've got it. The decision will stand. The match will stand. The stipulation will stand. The bodies are out. Everybody's always come up to me asking, how come you hate the Rock and Roll? How come you're so obsessed with the Rock and Roll Express? Well, it's real easy. Put yourself in my place. For 10 long years, all across the country, in every high school gym, every major sports arena, every wrestling promotion, I've done everything I could do to send my team after them to get them out of professional wrestling. Because I hate their stinking guts. Why? Why do I hate their guts? Because I've devoted my life to professional wrestling. Because I wanted to be the best. I wanted to manage the best. And every team that I've managed has been the best. Dennis Condrey and Bob Eaton and Stan Lane and Tom Pritchard and Jimmy Del Rey. They've been the best. They've been without parallel. Nobody could touch them. Nobody could stop them. Nobody except the Rock and Roll Express. Every time that I got a team that was ready to take the top, the Rock and Roll's there to take the title, to take the glory, to take the attention, to make sure that all the fans could come up to me and say, you know, your guys are pretty good, but the Rock and Roll are better. And I've done the most horrible things that I could think of to do to another human being, to Ricky Morton and Robert Gibson, to try to run them out of wrestling. It didn't work. Of course, by the same token, they've had to endure those horrible things, and they never got that last measure of revenge until now. The decision stands. The bodies are finished in Smoky Mountain Wrestling, but I want you to know this ain't the only place that they can wrestle. This ain't the only place they do wrestle. But this is the place that they wanted to wrestle because they dominated Smoky Mountain Wrestling. They established Smoky Mountain Wrestling. If it wasn't for the Heavenly Bodies, there wouldn't be a Smoky Mountain Wrestling today.
That's right!
And Ricky Morton and Robert Gibson, you ruined all that. And you got your final revenge, and I'll give it to you. You did what you said you were going to do. After 10 years, man, the thing between me and you is over. And you got what you wanted. But I'm going to say this to you. I swear, I raise my right hand to God, Ricky Morton and Robert Gibson. There will be another day, somehow, sometime, somewhere. I don't know when. But there'll be another day between me and you, and between you and the Heavenly Bodies. But for now, you've seen the last of Tom Pritchard, and you've seen the last of Jimmy Del Rey, and I'm thinking seriously about going with them.
This is where they're walking off.
And you knew them all by heart.
This is it, right, Mr.
Now you move toward the door. Here it comes, the hardest part.
They're hugging.
Try to hand the love alone.
This can never be. Okay, we're not going to listen to more of the famous final scene.
Yeah. I mean, that's just, yeah, that promo by Cornette, Tim. Where would you rank that, like, as far as, like, his greatest promos ever? Would that be at the top, near the top? What do you think about that promo?
Yeah, it's up there. And I think there was one, I don't remember if it was the first Thanksgiving Thunder, there was one where he had to recap a bunch of stipulation matches and explain what they all were. That was really good, I remember, from that era.
The best thing about Cornette, though, in this era was the fact that they kept this so well hid that he was the guy in charge of the promotion.
Oh, yeah.
Locally, that is.
Yeah, locally.
But I would say that all the build-up for Bluegrass Brawl 93 is probably the best era in the promotion, and this part right here is probably number two, the aftermath of – or the main event and aftermath of Bluegrass Brawl 94.
And then you see how important the bodies were when they're replaced by Bruiser Bedlam. Oh boy. All right. Well, let's move on to the other half of the state of Tennessee.
And by the way, I probably should go good without saying that this was considered by just about everyone the best promo of 1994 in wrestling.
Yes. Yes. And I don't think there's anything close.
And if you have never seen the match that leads to this, the Loser Leaves Town Cage match from Pikeville.
Yes.
I don't know if it's online anywhere. For love of God, go watch it. That match is fantastic.
Where Ricky Morton vowed to retire if they lost.
Yeah,
the build-up is great, too, with Vince McMahon and Eddie Marlin sending in promos saying that the losers of the Loser Leaves Smoky Mountain match would be welcome to wrestle in their promotion.
Yes. I mean, just amazing stuff. Anyway, let's go to Memphis. And speaking of more great promos,
and Eddie Gilbert...
Yeah, Eddie Gilbert did an interview on the April 9th show, WMC, saying he wanted to team with Brian Christopher on the April 11th show at Mid-South Coliseum. But Christopher turned him down, saying he knew that the fireball that was thrown Monday night was meant for him. Eddie then told Christopher that he was the one who taught him how to use chains, and he finally convinced Christopher to team with him against Dream Machine and Adam Bomb on April 11th at Mid-South Coliseum with Doug Gilbert as the referee. Now, Eddie returned on April the 4th as he came to ringside during the I Quit main event with brother Doug, Tommy Rich, and Dream Machine versus Jerry the King Lawler, Hanson, Jimmy Valiant, and Too Sexy Brian Christopher. Eddie tried to throw fire at Christopher, but he ducked and it hit Doug, which ended the match. After the match, Dream Machine, Tommy Rich, and Adam Bomb all attacked Eddie for several minutes, destroying him. Finally, Lawler and Christopher came back and tried to help Eddie, but they were ganged up on and left laying in the ring as well. And on the 11th in Memphis, Gilbert and Brian Christopher beat Adam Bomb and Dream Machine with Doug as referee. But after the match, Doug attacked Brian Christopher with Eddie trying to separate them.
Adam Bomb and Dream Machine.
And Tommy Rich with Corey Macklin on commentary, Bix.
Oh, my God. I'm not sure this is real. It doesn't sound real. Wait, what? Had Adam Bomb turned babyface yet?
No.
What, that was a couple weeks away?
Something like that, yeah.
Okay. So which clip am I playing now?
You're playing the first one first.
Okay. So wait, am I playing the match or just the promo?
Yeah. The match, then the promo.
Okay. That's why I was confused.
Taking care of Christopher in the ring. Oh, that's a Jimmy Lawler. Oh, that's a Richard. Oh, look at that. That's Hot Stuff Eddie Gilbert.
And look at that.
Hot Stuff Eddie Gilbert here tonight. Not even supposed to be here. Throw fire on Doug Gilbert. Throw fire and catches his own fire with it. So it'll be Lawler, Valiant, and Christopher, winners of $6,000 in cash. Oh, look at this. Dream Machine and Tommy Rich. They jump on Eddie Gilbert. What in the world? machine. Out of Eddie Gilbert, being jumped on by the Dream Machine and Tommy Wildfire it. Oh, my goodness. There's referee Scott Bob. He's down now. After the Dream and Tommy Rich. Both lost $1,000 each.
I hope you understand what you're subjecting our listeners to right now.
Corey, the greatness of Corey Macklin. All right, now go to the promo.
The Eddie Gilbert promo or the one?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, good.
Because this goes on for another 3 or 4 minutes.
Yeah, just go to that. And we're not playing this whole clip because it's 15 minutes long, but we get to the important stuff. Go ahead.
What a wild, wild time it was there. You saw exactly what happened. And here comes Eddie Gilbert, a rather somber-looking Eddie Gilbert, as a matter of fact. He's not dancing out here, doesn't have on the shades, and his hot stuff outfit and all of that sort of thing here today. Eddie, we've just seen the entire videotape. We saw you hit your own brother with the fire. I saw Dream Machine, Tommy Rich, Atom Bomb all attack you there.
Well, I saw the same thing, Dave.
Well,
I felt it. This past week, I stood back there just a while ago watching the monitor, just like you. A lot of things went through my head. I tell you, a lot of things that night went through my head. I've done a lot of bad, bad things.
Yeah, you have. And that's kind of what I was thinking when we were watching there, that in a way, you were kind of getting maybe what was due.
Exactly. That's just what I was thinking about back there and everything. But I just want everyone to know right from the start set of this, of me talking today, that if for 1 second that anybody in this country, in this area, in the USWA, you, Dave Brown, Corey Macklin, Eddie Marlin, anybody thinks for 1 second that today I am coming out here to say I'm sorry for anything I've ever done here, you're completely wrong. I'm very proud of my past, and I'm very proud of what my future's going to be. The only people right now that better worry about their future are the people that took a boot to me, a person that kicked me in the ribs when I was down, a big old giant that thinks he's something. You better worry a lot right now what's on my mind, and that's what I want to talk about, what's on my mind right now. All week, I've had all week to think about this. I've had all week to try to come to a conclusion of what to do, what's the next move. I've always been good at these plans, to come up with the right plan at the right time of attack, to come up with the most devious, the most cleverest plans in professional wrestling, and you know that, right?
Well, I've got to admit that point. Yeah, you come up with plans. I don't always like them, but you do come up with plans.
That's right. I do. I do. I come up with the best plans. And what I would like to do right now is that I would like to call someone out here because I want to ask him something, and I want to talk to him right out here in front of everybody. I don't want to pull any punches. And Brian Christopher, if you're back there watching the monitor, I wish you would come out here right now, if it's okay with you, Dave. I just want to talk to this guy, Brian. Well, if you're back there watching, if Eddie Marlin can see this, and get Brian.
There he is. Eddie, I don't want any trouble out here. I mean, you've just said you're not apologizing for a thing you've done in the past.
I am not.
And I know you and Brian have had trouble in the past here, and I don't want any trouble out here today, even though I did see in the videotape that Brian came to help. Now, let's keep this calm here.
All right. First off,
what is it, Eddie?
First off, I'm glad you took the time to come out here. I really am. After watching that tape, after knowing what happened this past week, the way I felt, I remember at the end of the match, and I was standing there out on the floor, and I looked around when I wiped the blood out of my eyes, and I see you standing there, and I see Jerry Lawler over here to the right, which I really don't want to talk about that right now. But I look, and I see you. And the first thing I'm thinking about, a lot of things just happen in our world all the time. We never thought that the wall would come down in Berlin, but it did. I never thought I'd ever see Brian Chris for whatever reason you had to come back to the ring. I don't know what that was and don't really care. The only thing I know at the end, and I was feeling real bad. I can tell you about pain from that. I felt real bad. When I wiped the blood out, I see you standing there. So I left that night and all week going, man, I want to go after and get a piece of these guys real, real bad in the worst way. But I'm not stupid. Not stupid. Well, what you may think otherwise, but I don't really care right now, okay? All right? I don't really care whether you think I'm stupid or whatever you think about me right now. I've just got one thing to ask you. When a person goes into war, when he goes into battle, He wants to have the greatest group of fighters that he can get and gather around him when he goes in there. All right? So what I'm asking you is, will you be my partner against these guys?
Brian, think about this.
Will I be your partner? Will I be Eddie Gilbert's partner? Will I be your partner? How soon you forget, Eddie Gilbert?
What?
How soon you forget?
Forget what?
I guess when they were bashing your head in, do you know why they were bashing your head in? It's because you came running out there trying to burn me. That's right. Not for the first time, but for the second time. Because right there, you burned me once before. Right out here, right in that ring, Eddie Gilbert. How soon you forget. But I did come running out there to try and save you. Just because for a split second, I felt sorry for you. While they were busting you over
sorry,
the head.
You felt sorry for me.
For a split second, I did. And now you have the audacity to ask me to be your partner after everything you've done in the past, everything you've done to me, everything you've done to Jerry Lawler, all the ripping up of the jackets here, Sam Bass, busting the pitcher, everything you've done.
Sam Bass.
You want me to be your partner?
Dave, what do you think? Well, I agree with Brian. I mean, you know,
what about you're not stupid? I'm not stupid either, Eddie Gilbert. And you talk about all these plans you've had.
Yeah.
What makes me think this is not just another one of those devious plans of yours?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, hold it. Hold it. I feel like we're Ross Perot and Al Gore out here for an hour for a second. Okay. Let me just
talk about NAFTA.
You now, because you're starting to make me just a little bit mad with what you're saying.
Oh, really?
Wait a minute. Dave, listen to me here. Listen to me out. Okay, how soon we forget, all right. How many months ago was it, Dave, that I remember tuning in to the TV station here, and I remember seeing a thing that happened. Jeff Jarrett out here with Jerry Lawler, and Eddie Marlin came out here and said, the computer has given us the third man, the best wrestler in the USWA, to defend the USWA against the WWF, and that man is Brian Christopher, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
and then when you came out here,
New York's computer,
they questioned you. They said, how can we trust you, Brian Christopher? Now, all of a sudden today, you're Mr. Self-Righteous. You went through what I'm going through today just a few months ago. You know exactly what I'm talking about. No, you're not stupid, and neither am I. But what I'm asking you to do is maybe just for one night, just put everything behind you.
What's good for the goose is good for the gander. Just think about it. Just think about it. You're the man I want. You're the man I know to get the job done. You're the man I... Just admit it.
Why me?
Well, just admit it. When you look in the mirror, Brian Christopher, you're really seeing me.
Oh, I love that line.
You dream when I look in the mirror I was seeing you.
See, once again, you jump to conclusions. That's not what I'm talking about. Who was together... Who was the one that got into your mind and said, hey, pull those chains out. Pick up a chair. Knock them in the head. Pull out some salt and throw it. Pull out some powder and throw it. Do some sneak attacks. Run in from behind. If you have to throw out fire, throw fire. Do whatever you have to do. That's the man I'm talking about. That's the man I want to be my partner. Now, will you be my partner?
I'll tell you what. You were the man that got me to pull the chains out.
Yeah.
You were the man that got me to use the chairs to do whatever it took.
Yeah.
I guess you were the man that put the gold around my waist, we could say.
Yeah.
So I'll tell you what, Eddie.
You're still not sure, though, are you? You're still not sure. Come on, just a second.
Come on. I'm still not sure, and the fans still aren't sure either.
Okay. You got it, Eddie Gilbert. You got it.
Okay.
And boy, this week, you're going to get it.
because you're going to regret ever messing with Brian Christopher and ever turning your back on Eddie Gilbert. You got it, Eddie Gilbert.
All right.
The handshake of partners coming up this week.
How about Eddie Gilbert?
I really miss Eddie Gilbert.
God damn, what a great promo Eddie Gilbert was. And Tim, you know, this is, it was April 94, so we're less than a year from his death. And, I mean,
And Brian Christopher at that point was reason enough to get Memphis tapes.
Oh, Brian Christopher, the lost, forgotten, great performer in Memphis history, I think. Because everybody wants to remember Brian Christopher from Too Cool and Dancing Rikishi and Grandmaster Sexay. But Too Sexy Brian Christopher in this era was amazing.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I've seen this particular thing we just played because I was looking back at my list while it was playing, and it looks like I kind of stopped watching it between like late 93 and early 94. But yeah, just those two together. I mean, what more do you need to say? And you just heard it.
Yeah, Eddie was so awesome there. So awesome.
I mean, yeah, Gilbert's one of my favorites of all time. So
yeah, it's a shame. All right, other things happened on television. The Spiders debuted on television. I was told they didn't get over, although they did some good flying moves. And the Spiders, of course, were Biggs,
Chaz Warrington, and Glenn Ruth, the Headbangers.
That's right. Also debuting were Axel and Ian Rotten, managed by Freddie Fargo. Freddie Fargo claimed that he was a distant relative of Jackie Fargo, but said that Jackie was the black sheep of the family and said he was nothing but an old drunk. And of course, Freddie Fargo is a frequent guest on Terry Garvin Sims' great podcast, frequent call-in guest on there. So, for those of you who don't know who Freddie Fargo was, yeah, he did some stuff in different independents and
Dallas-based guy, right?
Dallas-based guy, but did stuff here too. Axel and Ian Rotten—that's interesting. Them here, this time period here, considering, and I think they were going to ECW not too long after this.
Yes, are they still doing the British accents here?
I think they dumped it around this time, or tried to.
Now, did Ian ever do the fake British accent or stuff?
No, it was just Axel. Only Ian ever talked, really.
And then Axel came back in 95 and had dropped a bunch of weight and was in USWA during the Smoky Mountain feud.
He sure was, yeah. And he totally didn't have no accent then. He was just talking as himself. Now, Mr. Perfect was scheduled to be in for the weekend, including appearing on television, but at the last minute said he suffered a broken toe in a non-wrestling-related accident and will be out for a few weeks. He should be ready to work in time to start his WF commitments against Lex Luger in mid-May.
Actually, wait a second. When did the thing where Wade Boggs saved his life or did he save Wade Boggs' life? Which was it?
I can't remember, but I don't know if it was around
I was trying to figure out if this was related, but I don't think it is.
No. Now, Dirty White Boy was supposed to return on April 11th to face Doug Gilbert for the Smoky Mountain Wrestling title, stemming from a few weeks back in Memphis where Gilbert gave Dirty White Girl a pile driver, but he no-showed, so Billy Travis subbed and the Moondogs attacked him. Billy Travis subbing for Dirty White Boy, that's interesting. And that card at the Mid-South Coliseum drew 900 fans for a $5,500 gate. Oof. Listen to this card, folks. Ian and Axel over Jeff Gaylord and the Spellbinder.
Between the Sheets' favorite, Jeff Gaylord. And between Vix's, the Sheets' favorite, the Spellbinder.
Jeez, which guy's worse?
Vix's dream team.
And they're the a team.
Yeah, I know. The Spiders beat Leon Bullman Downs and Reggie B. Fine.
Bullman Downs was A, in Memphis, B, still wrestling at this point?
Yeah. USWA women's title, Debbie Combs beat Susan Sapphire. Then we had Travis and Doug Gilbert by DQ. Brian Christopher over Stephen Dunn. Moondogs over Billy Travis and Don Bass. And then Gilbert and Christopher against Adam Bomb and Dream Machine. So what a time and place here for USWA. And now we go to Potpourri, which got a little bit of Potpourri this week. Jim Ross is still recovering from Bell's palsy. And he's seeking opportunities outside of wrestling as well as inside the world of wrestling. Ross wants to return to announcing and would like to go back to WCW, but that appears to be out of the question. Boy, I'll say. Now, Tim, he was in Smoky Mountain at the Night of Legends, right? Isn't that where he made his debut?
Yeah, that sounds right.
So 4 months later, that's when he comes back. But
well, he did some WWF work before
that. Yeah, he did some, but...
Because when Vince brought him in, when Vince was on trial...
That's right. Yeah, that's when he really came back. But
no, he got fired again after that.
Yeah, he got fired. He came back and got fired again. Yeah. He had a hard time this time period, didn't he? Poor Jim Ross.
Yeah, wakes up on Super Bowl Sunday, half his face is paralyzed, and immediately gets fired.
Yeah, and then just had a hard year. Jason and Mark Robertson, or as we know them, Jason and Mark Sterling, sons of Byron Dewey Missing Link Robertson, tore down the house at Ricky Johnson's show on April the 8th in Hamilton, Ontario. I want to see that.
I haven't seen a lot of Mark Sterling, but Jason Sterling was really good.
Jason Sterling was, you know, in world class in like 1988, and he could do things, man, in the ring. But he was small, and he didn't stay long in world class. He was gone not too long after. But God, I mean, I want to see Jason Sterling in 1994 to see what kind of
great
matches. Great bumper, great look.
Go ahead.
I said a guy that Rob Naylor would probably pontificate about.
Oh, I know he's a Jason Sterling fan.
Yeah, I know brother Rob is a huge Jason Sterling guy.
I have on YouTube, or used to have on YouTube. If you look up a video, it says something like John Tatum and Jack Victory kill Jason Sterling. You know the one I'm talking about, right?
Yes.
It's so he used to do this spot where he, instead of doing a leapfrog, he would jump on his opponent's back, stand on his back for a second, then jump off.
Yeah.
And then do like a dropkick or something after.
Yeah.
So here he tries to do that to Jack Victory after John Tatum blind tagged in. And Tatum hits him with like a flying clothesline off the second
insane
rope.
Insane.
And I labeled it something like kill Jason, you know, John Tatum, Jack Victory killed Jason Sterling. It has something like 200,000 YouTube views because years ago, this made me lose a lot of faith in humanity. Apparently, people would search up kills on YouTube expecting to find murder videos.
Yeah.
And get really angry when my video showed up and comment negatively on it. That like, this is bullshit, this fake bro wrestling, he didn't get killed.
Yeah.
But it was because they were actually searching for the word kills and looking for people, actual videos of people getting killed.
Well, it's kind of like looking for bears and seeing Dale Veazey come up in your video search, isn't it? Or Arn Anderson.
Dale Veazey is a bear.
When you actually want to see a real bear, not an acronym.
Oh, you mean how are we defining a real bear?
No, like a grizzly bear. Like you want to see a video of a bear in the woods or something, not a guy, a wrestler.
And then here, the local strip club was bare necessity, even though it was just toothless women and not a gay strip club. It was very strange.
Yeah. Now, we talked about this earlier in the show, alluded to it, Sabu, and Dave said the Sabu Express was rolling again this weekend, having returned from Japan. On April the 8th in Flint, Michigan, Sabu and Al Snow had a 4.5-star match. While the next night in Taylor, Michigan, Sabu had a violent brawl with Terry Funk, rated 3.75 stars. And Tim, these were some of the matches that really put Sabu on the map on the U.S. tape trading scene.
Oh, yeah, I'm pretty sure these were on the infamous interminable series RF put out of Sabu volume whatever. And usually it was like 2 hours of stuff from that wasn't from ECW that would get traded around.
I believe he got at least to volume 16 of Best of Sabu.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
this was during the time period where there was a lot of coverage in the Torch, too, from like Chris Avisa was a manager, I think, on the Michigan scene.
Gideon Wainwright.
Yep, Gideon Wainwright.
Oh, that's right, yeah. Chris Avisa.
And this also put Al Snow on the map, too.
Unfortunately.
Oh, come on. Al Snow was awesome in this time period. I know now it's a different story, but he was awesome back then.
No, he was really good back then. I never got to see. I always wanted to see the Sabu stuff that were on the cards at Snow's gym.
Yeah,
I think Nishimura match is on YouTube.
Yeah,
but I haven't watched it. But Benoit versus Snow with Sabu doing the clothesline on the balcony, I don't think is on YouTube.
No, this was just a great era for that type of stuff that goes on. And Terry Funk, You know, here he is in rural Michigan having 3 3/4 star brawls with Sabu. It's great stuff.
I always wanted to see, like, the undercards on those shows always looked interesting. You're looking at the Torch and trying to remember some of the names on those shows. Calavera Cortez, Steve Nixon. Do you remember, like, all these, like, guys that only showed up on the Sabu headline shows in Michigan?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to remember. I always was kind of curious if those guys were actually any good.
Didn't T. Ranchula work those shows too?
He was a Pittsburgh guy, I think.
I know, but I think he worked those shows too.
He might have. That doesn't sound completely wrong.
Yeah. Why? Right. Moving on. Sid Vicious.
Sorry.
Come on.
It's better when you're not trying to give me the opening. It's better if I just do it and you don't expect it.
If you would read ahead of time, maybe you would understand what was coming.
I didn't think Sid was a dun worthy.
As much as we talked about him on this show. Anyway, Sid Vicious. Scheduled first match back since the October 26th stabbing incident with Arn Anderson in England. Was supposed to be on April the 9th in Essex, Maryland against Jerry Lawler for the MEWF. However, both main eventers no-showed. And listen to this. And Brutus Beefcake, who is available for weekend indies, and Kamala replaced them. Lawler had canceled several days earlier due to prior commitments, which I think was working in Nashville for USWA. And it was announced that Vicious wasn't there because of, quote, legal problems, unquote. Although from what we understand, Vicious won the first class plane ticket, and there was a $500 between the promotioner and wrestler of what he'd be paid, which all happened pretty well at the last minute. It's a difference. They announced Vicious not being there at the beginning of the show, which drew about 500 fans, and apparently nobody reacted. Later in the show, when they announced Beefcake as a sub, it was said that Lawler, who actually wasn't there, refused to come out and wrestle Beefcake, so Kamala subbed for him. Wow.
Guess what? I was at this show.
Oh, awesome. Tell us about it, Tim.
Oh, that's an amazing coincidence.
Yes, it is. As I came across this, I'm like, wait, I was at this show, and I'd completely forgotten about it. So any raw footage that may be floating around out there is mine. Yeah, I think the Heavenly Bodies were on this. I think the Heavenly Bodies were on this show was the only reason we drove to Maryland to see this. And I think I tried to set a record with typing the letter Z after the Beefcake versus Kamala on the tape list.
Who did the Bodies wrestle on the show?
I think it was just Maryland indie guys. I can try to look it up while you all are talking.
Q-Ball Carmichael and
Ace Darling, part of this show.
Q-Ball wasn't really an MCW guy yet at this point, or MEWF, I guess it was.
Cheetah Master.
Cheetah Master's not a Maryland guy.
I know, but he probably would have worked.
No, he wasn't a Maryland guy.
Earl the Pearl?
I don't think he had debuted yet at this point.
Jeez, wow.
Brutus Soda Pop that. Ronnie Zucco?
Before his time as well.
I know. I just tried to name all the Maryland guys I could think of. Shane Shamrock? No.
Way before that. All right. Now there's something I know about. WTLK, Channel 14 in Atlanta, which has a Saturday Night Wrestling block, was sold to a Christian broadcasting group. And will be cutting back to 3 hours of wrestling per week. The block includes WWS, Smoky Mountain, WCW, USWA, and it's the only outlet in the area for Smoky Mountain Wrestling, which is planning on making Marietta a regular stop. The station's penetration is weak, I'll say, because it isn't on cable in most of Atlanta or in Marietta, but it's the only outlet any of these groups have in the Atlanta market except WCW and TBS. Yes, this group, this station, I could not get in my town, but my brother was living in Griffin, you know, 15 miles ahead of me, and he could get this channel at times. It would bounce on and off the cable system.
But it was officially Atlanta. It was not like when you have, like, the weird New Jersey channels that people try to claim as New York.
Yeah, and Channel 14 now is a ION affiliate.
Well, if it was a religious station, that makes sense.
Yes, an ION affiliate, and it's still going. And right now they're playing Flashpoint.
Flashpoint is a great show. If you've never seen it, Flashpoint's actually really good.
I'm not making fun of him. I'm just sitting there playing Flashpoint.
I know, but have you ever watched Flashpoint?
Never have watched Flashpoint.
Flashpoint is actually really good. I would check this watching.
But what this signifies, though, is this is the end of Joe Pedicino and Bonnie Blackstone as television personalities in Atlanta. This was their block.
Now, also, didn't Smokey Mountain get kicked off of the station at the end of the year because of the death of Boots the Cat?
Yes, Boots the Cat got them kicked off. So, let's stay in Georgia wrestling.
Or, by the way, as Bruce Mitchell put it in his year-end quiz in the Torch, Tammy Sitch threatening to kill her own cat.
Now, I got to read these cards here.
All right, you want me to tell you who the Heavenly Bodies wrestled?
Yes.
Jimmy Jannetty and Ramblin' Rich Myers.
How did I forget Rich Myers and Jimmy Jannetty? And when I'm naming Maryland guys.
God, that's
should have gotten Ramblin' Rich Myers.
Yeah.
Also on the show, Nikolai Volkoff wrestled some random Russian assassin.
And this is right before Nick went back to WWF.
And somebody named Lucifer Knight of the Road wrestled Matt Osborne as Doink.
Why do I feel like I know who Lucifer Knight is?
So they had some, they must have had some money for this show. It must have been a big sold show if they were attempting to have Lawler and Sid and ended up with Beefcake Kamala and Matt Bourne on it and Volkoff, although he lived in the area.
And the Bodies.
Yeah, and the Bodies.
What a crew that was. Speaking of crews, Georgia Indie Wrestling for this weekend here. Now, I was not at these shows, so I'll go ahead and tell you a time. In Metter, Georgia, which is Metter is north of Atlanta, if not mistaken. It's in Candler County. Metter is East Georgia, excuse me. East Georgia, and this was for All Star Wrestling. Now listen to this card: Luscious Lonnie over Tito Santos. Don't know that.
Tito Bambi. Santos, is he the bootleg Tito Santana?
Maybe Bambi is where she went with Peggy Lee Leather over the Amazon Queen.
Well, let's be real: are we sure that Amazon Queen is not Peggy Lee Leather? Are we really sure?
Maybe that's her nickname for her.
That's the game that she took in the bedroom, isn't it, Dan? In this match, Bix, Rob Van Dam and Dick Slater going to a 30-minute draw.
I can't even imagine that.
So was Van Dam living in Georgia back then?
He bounced around a lot. And here,
but he worked a lot of Georgia Indies back then.
That's not even the main event. Kamala 2 over Jake the Snake Roberts was your main event.
That's probably a Greg Price All-Star Wrestling.
Yes, this probably is. It's in Metter, which is
with Van Dam, and he used Jake a lot around then, too.
Yeah. Now we get to the Scott Hudson, Steve Razak portion. As we go to the North Georgia Wrestling Alliance in Alpharetta, Georgia, Uncle Sammy.
At the Auction Barn?
At the Auction Barn, draw 180. Bola Do over Steve Pritchard. Scott Studd, of course, Scotty Riggs, and Lee Thomas. Over the Flame, which was being portrayed by Steve the Brawler Lawler, and the Mystic Warrior being portrayed by his brother, Terry Lawler, who still wrestles. Then you have Bobby Hayes over David Young. David Young, of course, got Wildside and worked other groups. Steve Pritchard over Mike Golden by DQ. And then he ran a tag team tournament for the North Georgia Wrestling Association tag titles. And The finals was New Jack and Sheik Mustafa Ali. Of course, you know who that is, Mustafa Saeed, over R.D. Swain and Ray Lloyd, of course, who become Glacier. So there you go. This is the beginning of the Gangstas run as a tag team. And they would work Smoky Mountain. In fact, they worked that Marietta show that Smoky Mountain was running. And that's where they got picked up by Smoky Mountain. So, yep. New Jack and Sheik Mustafa Ali. And Mustafa was quite a different gimmick at this time here than what he would become as a gangster. He basically was a sheik. He went from being an African bounty hunter who never talked, who was managed by Danny Deez, which if you listen to the Scott Hess's Steve Prazak show on Exile, you would know about Danny D's. He didn't talk. He had his face paint on. He went from that to becoming a Sheik. So we need to get North Georgia Wrestling.
They should have called him the Black Sheik. Wait, that's Abdullah's gimmick.
We got to get North Georgia Wrestling. I got to get up with Steve Prazak and get them tapes.
I want to experience Luck Not the Salvage Guy.
Yes. And in our final note, a sad note for Potpourri.
Now, wait a second. You missed another future name on this card.
Yeah, I was going to mention that as well. From the same era of Smoky Mountain.
Sam McGraw,
yeah. Who became?
Paul Buchanan.
Paul Buchanan, that's right.
He beat David Young, who did
Double David Young.
Well, was this a TV taping?
Yes.
What type of TV did they have?
They had TV in North Georgia.
No, but I mean, was it on real TV or was it public access?
It's probably on live public access at this time period. But yes, Sam McGraw would become Paul Buchanan. That's right. Good call. I missed that one.
Sunset Sam McGraw.
That's right. Now, like I said, as we end on a sad note here, is Ernie Dusik, who's the last surviving member of the original Dirty Dusik Brothers Riot Squad, one of my all-time favorite tag team names. The first famous heel tag team in this country in the late 30s and 40s, passed away on April 11th at his hometown Omaha at the age of 85. Dusik team with brothers Joe, longtime Omaha wrestling promoter after retiring from the ring, Emil, and Rudy. Dusik was a stage name for all the brothers, whose real last name was Hasten. And of course, Frank Dusik took his name from these Dusiks.
What is Frank's real name? I mean, I know he's not really part of the family, but I don't remember if I know what his name actually is.
Frank Santon.
Okay.
Yeah. But, yep, that's where the name came from. So anyway, we're going to say bye to Tim, as Tim has to go to bed as we're recording this late to get up early in the morning. And Tim, what have you got a plug this evening for?
I actually do have a plug. I will be at the Icons of Wrestling Collector Fest next Saturday. George Mayfield and I are doing a table there.
Oh, my God.
Philadelphia at the ECW Arena.
Awesome.
I saw George a few months ago.
Yeah, the convention's 9 to 3, and then there's a Tommy Dreamer show that night at the arena.
That's a hardcore, yep.
That's got KES against Hero and Cabana on it.
A rematch, yeah, rematch from Noah. Yeah, that's good. That should be a good match. Should be a good experience. And God, George Mayfield, that's a guy who we talk about tape trading. He was one of the big guys in the business in that era, for sure. Wow.
Yep, and just tell them that people are catching on to the whole "my daughter told me that she's getting rid of everything, so I'm charging less for it" thing he's been doing.
He's been trying to get out of the business for like 5 years, and he'll disappear for a year and then show back up and get energized again and then do some shows, and then he'll disappear again. But supposedly he's planning another Tokyo tour for 2017.
Yes, apparently he is.
Wow. God, I mean, that was when you went to Japan was for him, you know, that first time.
Exactly, yeah. Yep.
A lot of people went to Japan because of George Mayfield, you know, so that's one thing you say for the guy.
And I mean, some of them were never welcome back.
Well, that's another story for another show. But
yeah, I have some stories I could tell on that those tours.
Oh, I bet. But anyway, we'd like to
include one guy from Georgia.
Oh, God, I can only imagine. I'd like to thank Tim for being on the show with us tonight, and definitely would have him back in the future.
And, yeah, I'm on Twitter, Tim, WRESPOWR. So.
That's right. Yeah, go check
Thanks
him out.
Thanks a lot for having me. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Thanks, guys.
When we come back, we're going to go to WCW, and we got a lot of stuff to talk about here. We'll be right back. All right, now let's go to WCW. And there was a lot of talk all weekend that WCW officials are expected to come to an agreement early this week with Hulk Hogan. And several news reports said, reported on April 11th and April 12th in the New York market that if agreement is finalized before the weekend, it was expected there was a good chance that Hogan would be in Chicago for the Spring Stampede pay-per-view show, as it had been strongly hinted on WCW telecast. The Hogan hype.
One way to put it.
Yeah. The Hogan hype has been amazing, if only because the company has already started making Hogan the centerpiece of his company before it even has signed him. And with knowledge of Hogan... and with knowledge that Hogan's release from Titan Sports gives them the legal option to match any offer and prevent him from accepting the WCW offer, according to a report on a New York television station calling signing a Titan Sports source, which is consistent with information that we've received. If Hogan doesn't wind up with WCW, it will leave the company with a major egg on their faces. That wouldn't be the first or the last. WCW Vice President Eric Bischoff canceled a planned meeting on April 11th with AAA and IWC officials, Eric Bischoff and Ross Goeller meeting, in order to fly to Orlando and to attempt to finalize a deal with Hogan. On April the 8th, Bischoff and Ric Flair were in Orlando negotiating with Hogan and discussing potential scenarios involving him that would be used if he came in, which are believed to include Hogan winning the WCW title. Although Hogan didn't agree on the deal on April the 8th, some WCW officials felt there was a strong enough chance an agreement would take place before the pay-per-view show. Because of his contractual release with Titan, even if Hogan agrees to a deal, it would be 21 days after that point before he could legally sign a contract because Titan has the 21 days to match the offer. And if Titan matched the offer, Hogan still couldn't sign, which is why the offer is said to include such amazing revenue percentages of merchandise and pay-per-view revenue that there's no way Titan would match it.
And there was no way Titan would match that contract.
That is amazing. The belief is Hogan would still be able to appear in WCW pay-per-view and television events, just not wrestle on them, before officially signing, which is the key for Sunday's show. The current timetable seems to be that he wouldn't wrestle until the July 17th pay-per-view against Flair anyway. If Hogan's return to wrestling in the U.S. this summer or fall, which is certainly it seems probable, he will be given how much he will given how much he's talked about returning. WCW seems to be the only viable option. As for the potential of Hogan starting up his own company, while apparently has been discussed, there doesn't appear to have been any serious movement in that direction as far as talent and administrative acquisitions, and it would take months of planning before it could be put together. So that has to be viewed right now as a major long shot and a tremendous gamble. Signing with WCW would be a gamble because if it flops, it would damage the Hogan mystique as a draw, and most of what WCW has done in recent years has flopped. However, they have the financial resources to put big money on the table, so there would be no financial gamble for Hogan, and even in the worst-case scenario, he'd probably make huge money.
Okay, now,
let me read this one real quick. HBO officials have been denying all week that they would be even consider running a weekly wrestling promotion and have totally dismissed Hogan's claim of a major offer, but there was definitely some truth to the idea. They talked to Hogan about doing a limited amount of wrestling despite repeated denials from the company, but they didn't think anything ever got past the extremely formidable stages.
There's about a lot to unpack here. You know what? Maybe we should just read the next part first before we finish up on Hogan.
Okay. Meanwhile, Hogan's show Thunder in Paradise is currently syndicated in 45 countries and airs in 88% of the United States through independent syndication. Hogan told the Orlando Sentinel recently that, quote, there isn't something good about wrestling, as it was so good to me. And it's kind of like wanting to see an old friend again, you know? I just want to do it, unquote. Do it like Heather Klim. But, HBO and Hulk Hogan.
There's a lot of things to unpack here, and that's one of them.
Think about that happen.
You know, it's not a terrible idea.
No, it wouldn't have been.
Because you think of HBO during this era, you think of TVKO.
Yeah.
Which was the box. What's now just HBO pay-per-view or whatever you would call it for the boxing fights. It's not, I mean, if it's just on its own without a regular promotion, it's a little weird, but I guess that's the boxing model.
Yes.
And there's something that I could see why they would talk to him.
Well, Hogan's a hot free agent.
Yeah.
You know, he really is. He's a hot name. He's been away for a while, you know. You know, absence makes the heart grow fonder, they say. So, and this is, you know, he's still remembered as the WWF Hogan. Going to WCW would change that, though. But, and there's one thing, if you listen to the Ric Flair podcast with Bischoff, they tell the story about that meeting.
People forget this. Flair was the point man on bringing Hogan in.
Flair was the total point man. He actually admits it. You know, people want to talk about how Hulk Hogan ruined WCW. Ric Flair is the guy that wanted him in.
He talked about it on the podcast. I was like, are you kidding? I could do that match every night.
Yeah.
He loved how easy it was to work with Hogan.
Yeah.
Especially for the type of money they could draw together.
Yeah.
And they were, at the time, they were friends.
Yeah.
And he kind of personally pulled strings with Hogan to take the meeting and all that, and eventually it happened. Now, had Hogan been on WCW TV at this point, though?
No. They were alluding to him and talking about him, but no.
When was the first, we're at Disney MGM Studios and we're bumping into Hulk Hogan filming Thunder in Paradise video? That was after he signed?
Around the time, yeah.
I could have sworn that he had done an appearance in March.
I mean, he could have.
I could have sworn that he was on like one episode of WCW Saturday Night in March doing that, and then he wasn't around for weeks.
I don't know for sure. Like I said, the timelines sometimes get a little fuzzy. Right. And, you know, going this way back, I mean,
yeah.
I don't know.
Now, have you ever read Howard Brody's book?
Yes.
You know where I'm going with this, correct?
Yes. Go ahead.
Okay, so earlier we're talking about Ring Warriors, which was the show that Howard Brody and Hiro Matsuda did, where they got New Japan tapes and they did English dubbing, and it mainly ended up being for the European market, airing on Eurosport, and it was different announcing teams with different combinations of Bruno Sammartino, Craig DeGeorge, Sir Oliver Humperdinck, and who am I forgetting? Or is that it?
Gordon Sully.
Yeah, Gordon Sully. And at some point, Matsuda was like, I can try to get Hogan involved. You know, because I trained him. So,
yeah.
In the book, Howard Brody claims that Hogan was like, not signed with them, but was in with them enough that there were like plans to like do Ring Warriors stuff with Hogan, and Hogan going back to New Japan would be part of it, and blah blah blah. And I have no idea how much I buy it. Like, what's your thoughts on this?
I think it's just a load of crap. But with Hulk Hogan, there's so much crap
that you don't know. I can see Hogan completely playing them.
Yeah, that's what I think. I think it's a bunch of crap on Hogan's part. I think they actually believed it. That's the thing. I think they actually believed that he was being truthful with them.
Do you believe they were able to line up all sorts of deals based on Hogan saying he was committing to it?
No. No.
I do believe, though, that Hogan, like, if Hiro Matsuda called him while he was trying to negotiate with everyone, that he would have done this, though.
Yeah, because he's loyal to Hiro Matsuda,
and that he would, but that he also would have strung them along and all that. Just to have this other party bidding for him, theoretically.
Yeah. Now, Derek Bischoff canceling a meeting with AAA and IWC officials.
Which translated to English means Antonio Pena and Ron Swoller.
Yes.
Well, that would happen anyway, so.
Yeah, it happened anyway. So, and this is Bischoff. Bischoff's starting to...
He just got promoted.
He just got promoted, and it did Torch Talk with Wade on the 6th, which there wasn't really a whole lot of meaty stuff in there, but Bischoff had, you know, now Bischoff's starting to become the boss. The big boss.
The previous, so now he is Senior Vice President, Executive Producer.
Yeah, he's still answering to Bob Doo, but he's becoming the big boss.
And I guess the previous year or so, he had just been Executive Producer.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Which was, people don't understand that. Bischoff was not in charge of WCW per se until around this time.
Yeah.
He was in charge of television.
Yes.
At first. And then, I mean, there's not too much to the interview.
No, there's not.
I mean, him and Wade, that you don't necessarily think we heard about till years later, like Ninja Star Wars.
Yeah, if you watch the JBL show, I mean, the Eric Bischoff backstory is word for word from what Torch Talk had. So, I mean, that goes to show you. I mean, he wasn't lying about anything. He was telling the truth. So, anyway, But yeah, I mean, it's just Hogan coming to WCW just changed the promotion altogether, and it's Ric Flair's fault.
And this is literally everything word for word. Like, well, I was living in Detroit, and then I moved to Pittsburgh, and it's like, it's literally the exact same interview.
Thank you, Ric Flair, for bringing Hulk Hogan to WCW. All right. Well, as this is going on, the status of Brian Pillman and Steve Austin has to be considered murky, as Pillman's contract expired a few weeks ago, but he's fulfilling his commitments through the pay-per-view, but isn't on the booking sheets after the show. And the sides are far apart enough on figures, as WCW's offer was a serious pay cut, believed to be in the $50,000 to $60,000 per year range from the $240,000 to $250,000 per year range and $190,000 per year range. That looks difficult to come to an agreement. Austin is on the sheets through the end of May, but his contract expires well before that, and it was known he wanted a significant raise, but WCW offered him a pay cut as well. The fact that Pillman and Austin come off a year where they were the best tag team in wrestling and being two of the only top-level performers the company has are probably the two that show the most potential for the future that aren't pushing 40 are being offered cuts has made everyone else coming up for renewal in great moods as well. Obviously, the line is there that there's a mandate that the company has to cut back on wrestler salaries because of how much it has lost over the years, which is believable. But it's hard to justify that to some of the wrestlers when the amount being offered to Hogan is probably as much as the total combined salary per year of everyone being asked to take a cut. Not to mention the added expense of announcers and renovating Center Stage Theater. Gene Oakland on the WCW Hotline acknowledged Austin's problem and say maybe departing WCW for parts unknown. Reports we've gotten seem to indicate that there will be an attempt to sign Austin, but that Pillman's leaving is pretty much acknowledged. If one or the other leave, the only viable options would be WWF, All Japan, or the Indies.
Well,
neither happened. They both stayed. Both were de-pushed heavily.
Brother.
Huh?
I said brother.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy to think about how bad they misused those two guys. They weren't Hogan guys. And this is Flair, you know, again, Flair bringing in Hogan and, you know, cutting off the nose spiders on face, you know, because he had these guys that were working hard that were his type of guys that get eaten up.
And Austin was ready to be a main eventer at this point.
So ready to be a main eventer.
I mean, for everything we talk about with him finding himself as a promo in ECW and then his WWF run after, he had gotten really good on promos at this time.
I firmly believe that Austin should have beat Flair for the title. And then you could have ran a Sting Austin feud, which would have been fun as hell in 94.
The Austin matches were, the Sting matches were Austin's last really good to great WCW matches.
Yes.
That match they had on Saturday night, like around June 95, is fantastic.
Yeah. Sting and Austin had good chemistry together whenever they worked against each other, which was rare. Because they very rarely ever did it.
And also the tag match, like when they had that tag match in 94 that was on Saturday night, which was Sting and Steamboat against Austin Flair.
Yeah. Hell of a match.
Just a tremendous match.
The stuff was there. I mean, there's so much that could have been done, but that's study. Speaking of Sting, Sting is said to be close to a deal to start a Hercules remake movie that filmed this summer, which didn't happen. And
I hope it did.
I'm thinking that...
When did Kevin Sorbo Hercules start?
That's what I'm checking. It started in 1995, so this may have been the TV show.
Did it start with like a pilot movie?
Yeah, January 16th, 95. It's part of the Action Pack. Remember that?
Yes.
Where it was a different show every week.
Oh, it was like a different like movie pilot thing?
Yeah, it was Hercules, Bandit.
Wasn't that really awful one from a few years later? Cleopatra 3000 or whatever.
Yeah, I'm going to Action Pack now. Action Pack started in 1994. Hercules, Tech War, Midnight Run, Bandit, and Vanishing Sun.
Wait, Tech War was on in syndication too?
Yeah.
Okay.
It debuted in 1995. Vanishing Sun, though, aired in 1994. So, yeah, think about that. All right. Sting could have been playing the role of that Kevin Sorbo had. Imagine that. Wow.
I wonder if that's there's anyone listening to this who is asking, who's Kevin Sorbo?
Yeah, it's Hercules. The guy who played Hercules. I'm telling you.
That's what I'm saying. I wonder if anyone's listening to this interest in older wrestling, I would hope that they at least know who Kevin Sorbo is.
Go look at Kevin Sorbo's IMDb. He's been in a shitload of movies recently. He does movies all the time. The guy stays busy. I mean, they're like direct video movies, but still, the guy's busy.
Didn't he have a lot of health problems at one point?
Yeah, he's like Dean Cain. He just does it. He'll do anything right now for a job. I mean, he just does anything offered.
You know what I never noticed before? He looks what? Just like Dolph Lundgren.
Kind of, sort of. He's got more hair than Dolph does now. I mean, they may have the same type of amount of hair now.
But facial features, though, very similar.
Yeah, there's a resemblance. Now, at the TV tapings on April 5th in Columbus, Georgia, which I've been to many times, Ric Flair worked as a babyface since he'd be in the face role for Slamboree, teaming with Sting against the Nasty Boys. And they did a TV feud with Bad Attitude, Steve Kern and Bobby Eaton as a tag team, against Arn Anderson and Ricky Steamboat. But the biggest news was Barry Darso was backstage at the show, so he may be returning. Yeah, Flair would flip-flop face and heel so much in 94 is crazy.
He didn't really turn heel until the Sherry thing.
Sherry.
The only false start really was the Steamboat thing, wasn't it?
Yeah. Bad Attitude. Steve Kern and Bobby Eaton.
Weren't they going to be called the Fabs and then something led to them not being called the Fabs?
I don't think they were going to be called the Fabulous Ones. I think there was going to be something maybe in Fabulous involved or something like that. I would say they would have been called the Fabulous Express. That'd been great. But Arn and Ricky Steamboat, that sounds like a fun-ass babyface tag team, doesn't it?
No, here's what their name should have been. It would have been terrible, but also would have been awesome. Fab Attitude.
The bad ones. Expect Cactus Jack to get reconstructive surgery in his ear after the pay-per-view match. So he'll be out of action again for a few months as he doesn't seem to be in the plans. Well,
I don't think he got any kind of reconstructive surgery. The thing he had on his ear, like the small ear-like structure that was rebuilt, is that the one that was there from the day he got the original surgery?
I think so.
He might have actually gotten a little bit more repairs, like right after. I'm not sure.
Yeah, but he didn't miss any. I mean, he was a Slamboree, as mentioned. So,
and then at WCW, of course, did nothing with it.
No, of course not.
You know, here's what's weird about that. It's like, okay, I sort of get it in the sense like that they were running other programs, but you were running this as a headline match on your European tour. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Like, why? So if this is so out of sort, why were you running Vader versus Cactus Jack anyway?
I don't know. They could have made something out of it. I mean, any smart promoter would have.
And that European tour drew pretty well, didn't it?
Yeah, they had success there. They were a fresh product there, different WWF. Now, Ricky Steamboat said on the Wrestling Insiders radio show, of course, Mike Tenay, on April 10th, that he and Ric Flair have a personal competition in a match who could see which one gets tired first. So expect a long match with fast pacing or else. Neither will get tired. Steamboat also mentioned his son, who is now 7, has already started amateur wrestling. Of course, Richie Steamboat, who had a little NXT run there for a while. But
too bad we don't have any Crash the Terminator items in this week's show.
Steamboat Flair, I could see him having a competition for that. I mean, that.
I can see Flair having a lot of competitions for a lot of things.
It was funny to me that watching the Hall of Fame that Flair brought up that Steamboat Christmas story, the one he talks about on the podcast all the time. He had to bring it up at the Hall of Fame.
I forgot what it was.
The one about the Christmas payoff in 78. He brings it up so much, and he brought up at the Hall of Fame. Hilarious. All right, ratings. Saturday night did a 2.1 rating on the April 9th show, which is even worse than it sounds considering they've been building angles week to week.
If you can't tell, we're recording late.
Yeah, and the Sunday show was preempted, which traditionally ups the Saturday rating. WCW Pro did a 1.6. I just had a quick yawn real quick. I'm talking about 1994 WCW, so sometimes that happens. Now, WCW ran three house shows over the weekend, drawing about 900 in a 14,000-seat building in Manhattan, Kansas.
There's a 14,000-seat building in Manhattan, Kansas?
Yeah, it's the basketball arena. It's Fog Allen Arena, where the Jayhawks play.
Okay.
Oh, wait a minute. No. Okay. Manhattan is Kansas State's basketball arena. So...
is this one of those confusing things, like the different Tennessee schools and the different Kentucky schools?
Well, okay. Yeah, Kansas State's in Manhattan. Kansas is in... oh, shit. The name of the town's escaping me.
Topeka?
Right. No, Lawrence.
Kansas City?
It's in Lawrence, Kansas. Okay. That's right. So, yeah, so they were playing Kansas State's basketball arena. The House of Pain is what it's called. For Kansas State basketball.
900 fans.
Yeah. And they did 2,000 in Kansas City.
I guess that's better than 1,500 paid at the Superdome.
Yeah. And in Springfield, they did 2,000 as well. So bad, bad, bad. The first show was said to be bad. But Casey was said to be a hot house show. Flair and Vader were scheduled to headline all three nights. But in Manhattan, Flair missed the show, which was announced going into the building and over the PA, blaming transportation problems, since he was in Orlando all day negotiating. And Arn Anderson wrestled Vader. And in Springfield, Vader missed out, so Flair wrestled Orndorff. That's an interesting match.
Hmm.
In Kansas City, Flair were 100% face all weekend, won by a DQ when race interfered. And Steamboat made a save for Flair, but afterwards, Flair and Steamboat had words, and Flair turned heel at the live show. So, WCW house shows, 1994, they just now really starting to get back going on that stuff, because Bischoff pretty much cut them off completely.
And rightfully so.
So, and you see why, with these attendances, that's for damn sure. But anyway, that's it for the show this evening. Bix, what do you have to plug for us this week?
I don't know.
Besides your yawning.
I'll just plug 605 Super Podcast. This week's show.
Bozo.
Now I'm forgetting. It's the own title. Let me look this up for a second. It is 605 Super Podcast, episode 20, Bozo Visits the Zoo. Which is taken from a Piper's Pit where Hogan shows up. And what do we have? Have you listened to this yet? At least in part?
Yes, I have listened to this show.
And let's see, we've got the first edition of the top 10 members of the Super Universe.
Mm-hmm. Joe Mamba.
Yes. Jamie Ward does the Dentist of the Week.
Which I read as Jamie.
You didn't just assume it was Jamie?
Yeah, but I just read it as Jamie.
That should have been Jimmy Garvin's nickname when he was Freebirds.
Jammy Jam.
Just he could have just been Jimmy Jam. Just could have been Jammy.
Jammy Jam Jam.
We talk about Adrian Adonis and becoming adorable Adrian. Plus, talk about a little bit about when wrestlers would bring up steroids on promos in the 80s. So we didn't have everything we would have wanted as far as playing clips. Like, I've never seen any of the Hercules stuff where he's pointing his bicep and going, yeah, whatever it is, like 500 cc's of Dianabol a day or whatever it is. And also we got part two of our talk with Bobby Simmons covering his whole time working under Jim Barnett as the office manager in Georgia Championship Wrestling.
Working under Jim Barnett as far as in professional terms.
Yes.
Not personal terms, thank you. He's not my type, my boy. He just doesn't fit what I look for. Working under Jim Barnett. You know better than that. All right, moving on.
And the last part of our thing with Ron Scholar, talking about When Worlds Collide and all that good stuff. And yeah, that's at 605pod.com as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, etc. We're probably going to try to make sure the shows don't go quite as long now after the last few weeks, but you know how I am and with Chris and with everything, so who knows? Who knows how that'll work out?
I mean, it's not that bad.
It's going to be more of a Terry Bollea-length show than a Hulk Hogan-length show.
Of course. Wouldn't have it any other way. So you're done, or what about your Twitter?
Oh, I thought we were doing that at the end. Follow me on Twitter, @DavidVix, and I guess that's it for right now, right? It's late. My brain's not working, so.
All right. Let's see. Of course, Between the Sheets every Monday, if you don't already know by now, and I'll go ahead and spoil next week's show.
I don't even know what next week's is.
Yeah, you should. I sent a message to you earlier in the week. Next week.
I just said my brain's not working. Give me a break.
Next week, we go to 2 years after this. We go to 1996, where we talk about Brian Pillman's car.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
So be ready for that one. So Brian Pillman car accident.
Where he gets secret plastic surgery to look like Shawn Michaels and feud with him. Or so Kevin Sullivan told people.
Yes. So anyway, that's coming up next week. All right. The latest episode of Exile on Bad Street is out.
It's awesome.
Everyone go listen to it. The second part of our Continental series with Carl Stern and Bo James. Talking about July 1986 through June 1987. Lots of great stories. Great Chris Colt story involving AIDS pamphlets. Buddy Landell, Kevin Sullivan, Stud Stable. There's all kinds of good stuff on there, so go check that out. I will go ahead and announce this, that there will be a Greatest Wrestler Ever podcast deal coming out on my end with our good buddy Dylan Hales. Johnny Gargano's favorite wrestling fan, and be on the lookout for that in the next few days. We're going to do two parts. So, because God knows if we did a full 100, that show would go 7 or 8 hours. So, we're going to break it up in two parts, 50 one, 50 another. So be on the lookout for that down the line. And other than that,
going to get through 25 at the most.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not going to be an Exile on Bad Street. It's not going to be a Between the Sheets. It's going to be its own little sub-series. So be on the lookout for that. Other than that, follow me on Twitter @KRISZELLNER for all the musings I have. Lots of Crying Jordan memes today. On my Twitter from Jordan Spieth's Epic Meltdown the Masters.
When do you ever not tweet Crying Jordan memes?
When Crying Jordan is the greatest thing ever. It's the greatest thing ever right now. I love it so much. You can do it in so many different things. So, yeah, go check it out. And, yeah, I'm trying to think of anything else. Talking Sheet Midweek. Yes, I can't forget that. I was on. If you haven't listened to last week's show, please go listen to it. Me, Les Moore, Celia Bloom, and Jeff Hawkins from Shit.
I didn't even see that there was a midweek this week. I thought I checked, and I didn't see it.
Yeah, it's up. We talked about Mania and stuff to come out of Raw and all that type of stuff, what our thoughts was. Jeff was there live and us watching on television. Go check that out. There's lots of good stuff on that show. And I'm sure we'll probably have another one this week, too. So we had to take a few weeks off due to other reasons with some of our hosts, but hopefully get back in the groove of it. So every Wednesday evening to early Thursday morning, Talking Sheet Midweek. Check it out. On that note, on SheetSandwich.com, by the way, that's where you can find that. And also, I got to give a shout out to Les for their main Talking Sheet show this weekend, where the entire Hales family, other than Dylan, was on. Papa Hales makes his first podcast appearance.
I thought Dylan was on that show.
No, Dylan was not on that show, I don't think.
I listened to a second of it, and I thought I heard Dylan.
Devin was on there, and Dustin was on there. And Papa Hales was on there, but I don't know if Dylan was on there or not. If he was, I mean, he could have been.
I could have sworn I just skipped through it a little and I heard Dylan.
I haven't listened to it fully yet. Dylan probably was on there. I just haven't listened to it fully yet. So, because I was at a wrestling show last night and I've had a lot going on. So I got to listen to it when I get a chance because it sounds awesome.
And of course, the Evolve stream was buffering for me when that happened.
Yeah, well, buffer everybody. It wasn't just you, brother. I'll tell you that.
I know. But, couldn't tell from the reaction. It seemed like everyone, like some people had seen it, but I guess that was only people who were there.
Well, but there was pictures and video tweeted out of it. So
okay, I missed those.
Yeah, that it was going. People were following in real time, and people that were there. So anyway, go check all that stuff out because Les is good people, and that's our, basically our sister brothers, Celia and Les.
Sister brothers.
Sister and brothers.
Okay.
Celia, Les, Hugh. That's our family. So go check them out. Anyway, that's it for tonight. We'll be back next week. The Sheets family. That's right. We'll be back next week for more Between the Sheets goodness. For Bix, of course, the rock of the show, who this show wouldn't be anything where it is without him. And me, Chris, saying so long from the Peach State of Georgia.
Bridges burned. Think of seasons that must end. See the rivers rise and fall. They will rise and fall again. Everything must die. Like an ocean to a shore, like a river to a stream, like a river to a stream. It's the famous final scene.